haven't got the Auditor General. Is the Auditor General right? Yes, right here. It's just the paper. We have the Mr. Shabangu, the Senior Manager, DTI Auditing. We have Mr. Kamalu, Manager, DTI Auditing. But this is from the Auditor General's office. And Ms. McCorpoy, is it? Who's arriving shortly with the documents. We would also like to recognize the DG of Trade and Industry, Mr. October. Is Mr. Khan here? Yes. Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Matamela, Acting Chief Group Operating Officer, Ms. Mataboha, Deputy DDG, Trade and Investment. Trade and Investment, where are you? Very critical position you are holding today. Very important. And then we have Ms. Mabichi Thompson, DDG Incentive Development and Administration Development. That's also very important, of course. Yes. Ms. Tandi Peli, Acting DDG Industrial Development Division. But we have Ms. Is it Marion Jacobs, who's filling in here for the DDG Chuani Group Services and Systems Division. Thank you. Mr. Zicordo. Yes, we go back a long way now, don't we? Good to see you again. Then we have Dr. Evelyn Masocha. Yes, you certainly have got tremendous stamina, I was telling the DG. And then Mr. Motlaka, Acting Chief Director. Oh, right at the back, yes. Good morning. And Dr. Shaikh, is it Shaikh or Sheikh? Sheikh, there we are. Advised to the Deputy Minister, thank you for being here this morning. And also Managing Director of Regent Business School. Ms. Makata McLawley, Chief Director, Agro Processing. That's right. If I have forgotten anyone, it is not intentional, and you will update the list. So if we can ask members of the committee, someone here to propose the adoption of the agenda. Honourable Tierko, seconded by the Honourable Williams. The apologies, we have a family apology from the Honourable Kadebe, and who else?
Chair, we have an apology from Mr. McPherson, who will be arriving late. Also, an apology from Mr. Mshlobo, he's just attending the doctor, but he will join the committee as soon as he's completed.
So those are three apologies.
Yes,
Chair. Right.
And Mr. Esterhazen.
Honourable Esterhazen has informed us that I told you about the four committees, so it'll be useful if you ask him just to let us know which committee he's in. Having done that, we now have the briefing. Are we ready for that yet? We're not, so we're going to go straight on to the consideration of the study visit report, the German leg, as it were. And we've, let's see who will be dealing with that. Will that be... No, but as who is... Yes, but you'll want, if anything has to be changed, the committee secretary needs to be with us to note those changes. This is a draft report. Not one member here wrote this report. Let's get that clear. But an attempt is always made to capture our views and position. And it is up to us now to go through this paragraph by paragraph to not the semantics, to confirm that this reflects our position. All right. Report report of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on a study visit to the Federal Republic of Germany. We then have the introduction there, the regulatory standards, architecture. We looked at industrialization with respect to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the second paragraph, the various business models, value change. And then I think just a little bit of a background about why are we calling it the fourth and not the second or third? The benefits associated with the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Well, Fourth Revolution, because as we learned from Germany, it's an ICT connection. Our greater efficiency, productivity, etc. One of the questions the committee asked to be addressed was labour. What would be the impact on labour and skills? That goes to the top of page 2. We then get just a little summary of the purpose of the study tour. And interesting enough, we often associate the word developmental with Africa, and yet Germany talks about the developmental path they are pursuing. And in that sense, I suppose it is with respect to the Fourth Industrial Revolution. You'll see again the impact on the labor force, etc. German stakeholders visited. We were very fortunate that we were able to engage with a variety, BM, the Federal Ministry there for Economic Affairs and Energy, Education and Research, page 3. The trade unions. It's an interesting difference to many countries that the German economy and Germany have an integral working relationship with their unions. And when we asked why, they indicated it was important to ensure that all components of whatever one was working with were factored in. All stakeholders were part of the decisions. And I thought that was the first time I'd heard that said in a first world country or developed country. We then went on to the German Federal Ministry of Economic Cooperation and Development, the GIZ, the Deutsche Gesellschaft für Internationale Zusammenarbeit, the German Africa Business Association, the Association of German Chambers of Commerce. I think we need to learn more about those last two. The German Electrical and Electronic Manufacturers and BMW. The delegation is noted. And then the outline of the report. An overview of the German business there, which you can read for yourselves if you have not already done that. What for us again was interesting was the significantly larger number of small and medium enterprises in a developed country, more so than its sister and brother countries in the European Union. And they pointed out and emphasized that it is through the small and medium businesses that they hope to increase employment, at least stabilize it and maintain it, or rather sustain it. Page 5. They then pointed out their support financially for the budgets of German chambers abroad. And I think that's an important lesson for us to appreciate. They consider it very important to fund those agencies abroad. And then overview of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And I'm going to simply read one paragraph there because I think you ought to study the next few pages. In principle, the Fourth Industrial Revolution consists of the development of cyber-physical systems. where physical objects are embedded with software, microcomputers, and sensors to allow them to become intelligent and to interact with each other. And they then spoke about the vertical integration here. The platform Industria 4.0 is what they are building upon. They emphasize the transformation of manufacturing to accommodate the fourth industrial revolution. The failure to include critical players, and this is what underpins the engagement with unions, would in future compromise the legitimacy of the fourth industrial revolution. The impact that is having, and if we look at that in detail, I think the last paragraph is pertinent for South Africa. On page 6, currently there is no clear holistic understanding about what the detailed implications will be regarding new educational requirements, new skill requirements, the impact on low and semi-skilled workers, and opportunities for digitalization. And right here, we're struggling with trying to transform and develop an appropriate educational system for our own country. But we cannot forget to keep in mind the fourth industrial revolution. Now, another important sentence is in the middle of the next page, 7, the second paragraph. They are of the view that the fourth industrial revolution may not necessarily lead to overall job losses, as it would create new types of jobs. Just have a look at an 18-month-old. They're no longer playing with the blocks, it seems, playing with their little tablets and other forms of the ITC, ICT, and computerization and digitization. Then you've got page 7 at the bottom, the need to plan in order to mitigate negative impacts. Page 8, the environmental perspective. And in South Africa, there's huge scope for that, as we've learned. How to harness wind, solar energy, bioenergy, etc., rather than fossil fuels. Process of implementation, how they are implementing it. We're talking about robots, and they introduced us to the concept of cobots, which in one sense speaks for itself. Cobot, you know, working together with a human. And an interesting development in order to reduce, perhaps, fears in the workplace. Page 9, the social compact. That particular point is, I think, what underpins the progress they've made so far. A social compact between industry, labor, and government. Page 10. They then mention all the business associations, the employee associations, and the importance of trade unions, which they regard as essential. Training, page 11. Interesting here that the local chambers of commerce, and I think this is important for South Africa, are an integral part and are responsible for organizing vocational education and training in partnership with government. I mean, this is how they're doing it overseas. And I think that we can take a leaf out of the book there, certainly. Now, as they point out, yes, academic qualifications appear to be more attractive, but it is important to foster vocational training, very important, and apprenticeships. They go on about the labor, vocational, and training. To page 11, I think I would really appreciate it if all members could read and study that page. 12, the rules and legislative framework. What kind of legislative framework are we going to develop for our own country? Because, no, we're not Germany, and we have to keep that in mind. Page 13. They then indicate the importance of communication, ensuring that there was dynamic communication between the private and public sector, and a new company is going to be established to deal with this. We then look at the key observations, and the last point for us remains important, and that it became apparent that notwithstanding the fourth industrial revolution, the industrial sector would remain a driver for economic growth and employment creation. I think if you would look at all of those points, 4.2 to 4.8 on page 14, the issues I've raised are reflected here as key observations again. And the emerging economies like South Africa under 4.5 have the opportunity. Now, this is a highly industrialized country who's well moving ahead on fourth industrial 0.0 or industrial 4.0. And they emphasize that emerging countries like South Africa have the opportunity to lead and adopt Industria 4.0's objectives, increasing their competitiveness. And the focus again on education, on the social compact, and finally our acknowledgements go to them and our own staff who were with us here. We certainly want to thank all the members who participated. Our recommendations then are, and I need to ask you first, have you read this report? Oh no, we can adopt it tomorrow if you haven't. I don't want you to adopt a report that hasn't been read. Can we rather leave this to tomorrow? Thank you very much. So we will now proceed with the first item on the agenda, and briefing by the Office of the Auditor General on the annual reports of the Department of Trade and Industry. It is unfortunate that this is an old agenda by the looks of things, and I did send a note to the secretaries to clean up the template, which is incorrect, and to upgrade this and update it. I spoke to you about SABS on Tuesday and about, you know, the others. So please, we're looking at DTI and the National Regulator for Compulsory Services and others, of course. So over to you, to the Auditor General now with us, not the Auditor General, but you representing him here and the office, Mr. Shabangu.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, members, morning, colleagues. We'll be taking you through the DTI portfolio's audit outcome for 2017-18 financial year. The outcomes will be excluding SAPS as well as NLC, as the Chair has mentioned, because their auditors have not been tabled yet. I'll be taking you through from slide number 1 up until slide 10. And then CJ will proceed with the presentation.
Go ahead.
Yes. Chair, slide 1 to slide 6. May I skip them with your permission? I think they are, we've been presenting them over the years, just the background in terms of the types of audit outcomes and so forth. With your permission, I can skip them.
Okay, thank you. I'm handing over the chair for 2 minutes to the Honourable Buyani.
Morning, you can continue.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was asking if I can proceed to slide number 7 with your permission. If we move to slide number 7, this just highlights the department and the entities that we have included in the presentation, as these ones have been tabled already. And at the bottom there, you'll see when we get to page 10, that the legends that we will be using there, those little arrows, that's where we explain them, but we will come back to the legends later. And if you go to slide number 9, this slide was there even last year where we just showed the summary of the process in terms of what we look at when we look at the entities and departments, the annual reports and their processes. We look at the planning, the do part where the actual work gets done, the checks and balances, and also the action. Slide 10 basically breaks down slide number 9, where we compared the DTI portfolio between 2017-18 and 2016-17. If you look under the plan part, we're saying there that the status of the action plans has improved. Hence, we're giving them the green arrow facing up there. There we're saying that when we look at the entire portfolio, the follow-up on action plans in terms of addressing the prior year's audit findings, there was a great improvement there in terms of whether the audit findings from prior year were being given the necessary attention that we expect. And so there we're saying they've improved. The next one under plan was the usefulness of performance indicators and targets. There also we've seen an improvement there, Chair. The next part, Chair, the do part, the overall internal control in the portfolio has improved as well from the previous year, as well as the basic financial and performance management controls and ICT controls. And as well as the vacancies in CFO positions has improved as well. And on the assurance side, the senior management and accounting officer accounting authority assurance provision has improved as well across the portfolio. Chair, can I continue? Okay. Yeah. Basically, this slide provides an overall perspective in terms of the portfolio. The details, Chair, will follow in the presentation later. Can I hand over to Sylvia to take us through the rest of the slides? Because we'll end up repeating. Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, members. I'll go over to slide 11. So basically, slide 11 is just a snapshot of the portfolio. So when we start with the clean audits, we've seen an improvement from last year in terms of clean audits, and then in terms of quality of financial statements. We've seen a regression this year, a slight regression from last year. But just to emphasize what the Chair and Mr. Shabangu said earlier on, that SAPS and NLC are not included in the presentation and the percentages in the presentation. And then when we go to quality of performance reports, we've seen a drastic improvement in terms of that, because we didn't identify any issues on.
If I may ask, why are they not included?
Chair, through you. Yes, I mentioned earlier that they are not included because they haven't been tabled yet.
Yes. We did inform people last week and on Tuesday that they would not be here. That's why I asked for the agenda to be corrected, but it was not done by staff.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Like I was saying, in terms of quality of performance reports, across all entities, we did not find any material issues on performance reports. So there was an improvement from last year. And then findings on compliance with legislation, it's also an improvement from last year. The only two audits which had findings on compliance were NRCS and then it was ECIC, but it was an improvement from last year. And then the last one now, irregular expenditure. Last year we had 11.4 million irregular expenditure across the portfolio, but this year it has gone down to 7.6. So there is an improvement from last year as well. Now, going to slide 12. So basically, slide 12, we're trying to capture the audit outcomes of the portfolio over the past 4 years. So if we look in 2014-15, we had four clean audits. And then when we go to 15-16, we had six, and 16-17, we had six. And then 17-18, we had seven clean audits. So over the past 4 years, we've seen an improvement in clean audits. And also, when you go to unqualified with findings, we've seen an improvement from five in 2014-15 up to one in 2017-18. So there was an improvement. And then slide 13 here, we're just looking at e-movement as to how many audits improved, how many remained unchanged from last year, and how many regressed. So we can see on the first block that NCC and NCR, there was an improvement. Last year they were unqualified with findings. Now it's unqualified with no findings. And then DTI, CC, NCT, and GP remain unchanged in maintaining their clean audit status. And then NRCS remain unchanged in terms of their qualified opinion. And then ECIC, it regressed from last year. Last year it was a clean audit and then it came to an unqualified with findings. And mainly the compliance findings here was material adjustments on the AFS. And then slide 14, that's a movement on the quality of financial statements, annual performance report, and compliance. So from last year, we had one qualified audit, and then even this year, it's still one qualified audit in this presentation, which is NRCS. And then we have eight unqualified with finding unqualified audit opinions this year. Basically, it's the seven clean audits and then one unqualified with finding. And then when we go to findings on annual performance report, as mentioned in the earlier slide, that we've seen an improvement from the prior year. This year, all the entities, we did not find any material issues on performance reports. And then in terms of compliance with legislation, in 16-17, we had four entities which had material non-compliance with legislation. And then in the current year, we only have two. And the other one was the material adjustments on the AFS, which was ECIC and then NRCS. And then slide 15, which is talking about now the status of the internal control in the entire portfolio. So we're checking the overall internal control. So in terms of leadership, we've seen an improvement from last year. Seven entities, we assess them as green in terms of internal controls, and then we only have one entity which was in a yellow in terms of leadership. And then financial and performance management, we've assessed overall that there were six entities which had good internal controls, and then we had two which were still in a yellow in terms of concerning. And basically those ones, it was NRCS and I think NCC. And then in terms of governance now of the entire, of the portfolio, we were comfortable that there were good governance controls in the portfolio, which is the same as last year. So in terms of assurance provided, so we have three assurance levels. The first one, it's senior management, accounting office, and executive authority. And then the second level is internal audit com, and then that level is portfolio committee. So there is an improvement from last year on senior management in terms of assurance provided. We had three entities where they were providing assurance, and then five entities are providing some assurance. So there was an improvement from last year. And then accounting officers, we've seen also a slight improvement from the previous year. This year we had six entities which were providing assurance, and then two which were providing some assurance. And then executive authority, even in the previous year, they were providing assurance, so it remained unchanged even in the current year. And then internal audit, there was a slight regression from the previous year. We have 6 entities which were providing assurance, and then 2 which were providing some assurance. And then audit committee remained unchanged from last year. It was still provide assurance. It was even in the current year, all entities across the portfolio. And then portfolio committee remained unchanged even from the previous year in terms of providing assurance. Now, if we go to slide 18, it's where we check the financial health status of the portfolio. 17-18, we have 7 entities where we say it has good financial health, and then 1 where we say we identified more than 2 unfavorable indicators. Just to clarify the one that we identified, basically it's not that we say that the financial health status of that one entity is in crisis. Basically what we did is the department used what we call a modified cash basis of accounting as compared to entities which are using an accrual basis of accounting. So what we did was we took a department and then we said, let's incorporate the principles of an accrual basis of accounting and see the situation there will exist if it were using the accrual basis of accounting. And then from that, we identified that if we adjust it based on accrual accounting, we will get to a net current liability situation and then a net liability situation. So basically, we're just taking the principle from a graph accounting to a modified cash basis accounting just to see how will the situation look if they were using an accrual basis of accounting. Oh, and another thing was, first point there, you will see that we said the amount of 30 days accruals. Basically, this is that relationship between DTI and DERCO. It's those DERCO accruals which had a huge chunk on the accruals. So that's why we flagged them there as well. And then slide 19. Basically, here we're looking at unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless over the past 5 years. Starting with irregular expenditure, in 13-14 there was 0 irregular expenditure, but 14-15 we had 40 million, and then it went to 15-16, it went down to 11 million, and 16-16 to 17 million, and then 16-17 to 11 million, and then this year to 7.6 million, and it was rounded off to 8 million there. And then the contributors of the 7.6 million in the current year, they are captured in the slide as well. And then in terms of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, 2014-15 it was 142,000. It went up to 417,000 in 15-16, and then went down to 42,000 in 16-17, and then this year it's 83,000. And then the breakdown of the contributors of that amount of 83,000 is included in the slide as well. And then now going to slide 20. We're just doing a small analysis on irregular expenditure and supply chain management. So the first line, we mentioned that irregular expenditure decreased from 11.4 to 7.6 million. And then we have 2 percentages that we calculated. The first one, which is light blue, and then the dark blue one. Light blue one, it's 38%, and then dark blue one, it's 62%. And when you look at the numbers, if you add the 2.4 in 38% and then 4 million in 62%, they won't add up to 76. Reason being, here we're only looking at irregular expenditure that the first one, light blue, is irregular expenditure that we identified in the current year, which relates to the previous years, which was identified this year. And then the 62%, this is irregular expenditure, which was identified in the previous year. It mostly relates to multi-year contracts, and it's still continuing in the current year. So that's the 62%. And then we have that small gray narrative where now we're checking how much percentage of the total irregular expenditure represent non-compliance, which occurred in the 2017-18 financial year. And then we came to 16.7. So if we add the 16.7 plus the 4 million and 2.4, then we'll get to the 7.6 million. And then now on the bar graphs below, Here, it's just the clients where we identified findings are on SCM. And then in the previous year, we had three where we identified findings and one material findings. But this year, it has improved. We only identified two, which has had findings on SCM, and then 75%, which did not have findings on SCM, which is an improvement from 2016-17, where 57% was identified where there were no findings on SCM. Then here, slide 21, we just capturing the most common findings that were identified on SCM. Basically, on those two entities, it was mainly the preference point system, which was not applied correctly. So it was on the two entities. And the second one, which is competitive bidding not invited. In the previous year, we had findings on some of the entities on that, but this year, there were no findings. So there was an improvement from last year to this year. So slide 22, we're just looking at fraud and consequence management of the portfolio. We've identified that the bar graphs here, they just show entities which had irregular expenditure in the previous year identified, which was investigated in the current year. And we identified all entities which had irregular expenditure in the previous year. They were irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful or unauthorized expenditure was investigated in the current year, as compared to the previous year where there was one entity where it was not where irregular expenditure of that year was not investigated last year. And then going to slide 23, here we're just capturing findings that we reported to management for investigation this year. We had one instance, which is suppliers, which submitted a false declaration. We identified one instance, and then it was reported to management for investigation and follow-up in the new year. And then slide 24, here we're looking at the root causes across the portfolio. We broke them down into three. The first one is slow response to improving key controls and addressing risk areas. Second one, inadequate consequences for poor performance and transgressions, and then instability or vacancies in key positions. So in terms of slow movement, we've identified that two entities we've identified this as a root cause that they slow response in improving key controls and then addressing key risk areas, and one of them was NRCS. And then instability or vacancies in key positions. It was only one entity, so even in the previous year, there was only one entity, so that part remained unchanged from last year. And then slide 25, here we're just looking at what the entities had committed in the previous year, whether they acted on the commitments or they are still in progress of the or they not implemented. So what we did here, we took the positives which were either unqualified findings in the previous year or qualified to see if what they committed last year, they've acted on it in the current year. So under completed commitments, the first one relating to NCC. If we still remember, NCC was unqualified with findings in the previous year. They had committed to request the DTI to provide their SCM checklist to ensure that the checklist that is used is complete. Furthermore, the SCM checklist must be prepared before procurement is approved. We've seen an improvement in this since the client moved from an unqualified with findings to a clean audit in the current year. And then they also committed to do the three levels of review before the financial statements are submitted for audit. And then in this year, it has improved because they managed to move from an unqualified to a clean audit in the current year. And then on commitments, they are still in progress. NRCS had committed to improve internal control environment, including their IT environment, and then resolve the revenue qualification. But the revenue qualification still reoccurred this year, and then the first one is still in progress even in the current year. And then the last slide, it's talking about a status of records review. This review will be performed in the third quarter, and then we can brief the portfolio committee after that point. Thank you.
Mr. Shabang, well, no, not Mr. Shabang or Mr. Inkamalo, but both of you. Now, members, that is a briefing. If you need a clarification, it would be helpful to seek it now before we engage with the DTI itself and others. Honourable Williams? Right.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question. On the Auditor General's report, the one that appeared in the annual report of the DTI, it says there that there's an emphasis of matter and the material impairment. And it says there, it's on page 107 of the actual report, it says, as disclosed in notes 13.5 to the financial statements, material impairment of $32,503,000 was incurred as a result of potential irrecoverable receivables. And I just want to know what that means, and is that not, you know, a bad expenditure? What exactly does that mean, that $32 million in your actual report, in this document? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. Honourable Flanguini?
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just on page, slide 23, that you have noted that supplier submitted declaration of false declaration of interest. Can we have that supplier's name? And then there's another one at the very same slide that you said other, as in SCM-related allegations. Which ones are that? Can we note that those three other related allegations? Can we get clarity on that?
Right, and we do acknowledge you, Honourable Matlobo. We noted that you were at another meeting. Well, actually, it was a personal matter, yes, medically. Honourable Mantash, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Buyani.
Chair, Auditor General speaks about regression on quality financial statements. Can they unpack that?
Right, Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. My colleagues have asked a lot of the clarity that I would have sought, but on slide 18, it says that material uncertainty exists of whether the auditor, one of the auditors can continue to operate in the future, and this is quite significant. So it says there's one of them. Which one is it?
Thank you. Honourable Buyani.
Chair, thanks. We welcome the report, and one, I'm not so sure of the irregular expenditure from the 11.4 to the 7.6. Is it in terms of the goods that they supplied or they acquired, and also which entities exactly, so that we can be able to understand and be taken on board? Because only here we can see there's NRCS and NCC. So we need clarity as to which other entities that they must be looked at. And also, it's a page 19. Yeah, because here we just get some irregular expenditure contributors, NCS and then ECC. And we're told that even the portfolio, committee, so we must be clarified as to where and where does the portfolio committee did not do well and so. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Buyani. And thank you for taking the chair earlier. Right, over to the Auditor General's office.
Thank you, Chair. I'll answer some. CISO will assist me with some. I'll skip the impairment one. CISO will address that one. The false declaration one, we don't have the name of the supplier hand now, but I'm sure the department can assist also. And the third one, it was about the the SCM related allegations. I'll refer that to CISO as well. And the regression on the quality of AFS, I think it talks to, if we go to slide number 14. sorry. Okay.
Hard copy.
Oh, you have hard copies.
We've got hard copies.
Yes, because it's talking to the fact that last year there were six, and currently there's seven now, where there were adjustments in their annual financial statements that were submitted in May this year. So that's what we're saying. When you compare the quality of submission between the two financial years, there were more with changes than last year in the current year. And the other one, the question around which entity on the going concern part, there I think we try to give it away in terms of we're saying MCS, it's DTI. But then, like Sizwe explained, we're not raising the alarm bells because after we did our financial health analysis, we went back and unpacked to see, okay, out of the three indicators, because once you do an analysis, you must go back and get an understanding in terms of the answers. So when we unpacked it, we realized that one of the biggest contributors, especially around the accruals, was the DERCO approvals, and we engaged the management and the audit committee on that one. And we were happy to say that it's not a crisis. It's something that is reflected, but at least there's a valid explanation for it. And the other aspect is on the conversion that you just spoke about, that when you bring back the balance sheet back to the GRAP principle as opposed to MCS, so there's no crisis basically in terms of our assessment. And the other one, which entities for the 11 million that made up the 11 million of irregular expenditure? I think I saw it somewhere in terms of the detail. Yes, I think last year it was CIPC, NCT, NRCS, NCC, and SAPS. Yes, but we don't have the specific figures because currently we included the figures for this year that make up the 8 million, but the names for the 11 million are those. The other question. I didn't get the last question about the portfolio committee.
It's yourself, Honourable Buyani. Yes. Just repeat it, please.
Chair, I'm still checking the page here, but there are something irregular from the portfolio. Okay, Chair. I saw something at the portfolio committee. In governance status on internal control.
What's your page number? Because we're not
going over through Jefferson with your indulgence, Chair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was page 19 initially, but now I don't see it.
All right. Well, look.
Let's
give you some space. Yeah. 10, page 10. There we are. Your colleagues are all rushing to the rescue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's page 10, Chair. Thanks. Yeah,
we found the page.
They said we must check here. Yeah? Assurance provided by, and also portfolio committee remain unchanged in terms of provide assurance. So that is what I wanted to check. Can you please clarify that?
Thanks, Chair and Member. No, basically what we're saying there, in the previous year, the portfolio committee was providing assurance. So they were in a green in the previous year. So even in the current year. So we're just saying that from last year to this year, it remained unchanged. It's still providing assurance.
Were you talking to that one, Honourable Biyani, or internal audits? I mean, we're on page 10.
Chair, you're talking portfolio committee. And our understanding, portfolio committee, we think it's us, but I don't know whether this one is another committee. So that is why I wanted to check in terms of what is unchanged in the portfolio committee.
Oh, yes, on the oversight.
Yeah, in terms
right.
of your oversight provision, you say it remained unchanged from last year.
All right. I think just clarity.
With regards to things that are within our scope, not your other political activities. I mean, with regards to tracking the department's
right.
quarterly reports, following up on our recommendations and commitments, with regards to what's within our scope, not the other activities that...
All right,
yes.
I think first of all, let's do it, you know, just methodically. You're referring to this portfolio committee, number one. Number two, you're referring to something we said in our reports that was reported by us.
We track in terms of, yes, what you report in your minutes and stuff, what the things that you say you're going to do with the GDI oversight of their reports and following up on some of your commitments within the portfolio and the recommendations. So that's
right.
that's what it's limited
so
to.
So essentially, you're also having a little look at us,
true.
You know, and well, I suppose oversight for you, for the department and entities to provide services effectively, efficiently, but as well as in a regular manner, it requires effective oversight. And you're saying in our reports, it would certainly seem that an assurance may have been given by the portfolio committee. I think that's the clarification that is sought. That's all. Because it's not something we have met before. It's the first time we are encountering this. So naturally, we're trying to clarify where it comes from. There's nothing right or wrong about it. Yes, Honourable McLaw?
No, thanks, Comrade Chair. Well, I did put an apology. I came early for doctor's appointment. I think this slide, when you read it, it must be read together with slide 17. We must not lose that point that it must read together with slide 17. But what is always a problem from an assurance point of view, you get a portfolio committee given 100% that they do an oversight. You get the audit committee given 100%. Then you get an internal audit, which is 75% and partial assurance of 25%. Then you have the minister, executing authority, getting 100%. We have the DG, who's an accounting authority, getting 75 and 25. Then you have senior management. I don't know how do we tick the boxes, because they read it in terms of governance and best practices. If management is not doing well, those above, you will ask to say, what has been consequence management? You can't do well as a higher structure, especially the audit committee. The audit committee is not about how many meetings they sit, but it's also about the thing that the audit remedial action plan and all these other risk things that they must do in their portfolios, they are there, they are attended to, they are implemented. If not implemented, the higher structures must demonstrate that we took action. I've always found it very fun. It looks okay for the portfolio committee to have a green, assessment, which is 100%. It looks well for the corporate DG that you have 100%. But with respect to really to management practice, you can have a lower structure not doing well and the higher structure is being set. But it's not about the audit of this department. The department has done well. A regression, because percentage-wise and number, sometimes when you use the two, there is a move. And then sometimes depending on the volume, the volumes have an impact mathematically. But the Auditor General can say when they assess issues around the leadership and governance, because that's the most important one, leadership and governance. Because leadership must mean leadership in totality. If the other entities are not doing well at the bottom, there's something that is a weakness on those at the top. Even probably ourselves, if someone can ask a difficult, how will we get 100% and the department does not get 100%? But probably it's a debate for another day. But we must comment that the department have done well. Well, sometimes we have your own technology, they call it nomenclature. If we have reached a signaling corporate chair, like 100%, the audit language, they always say unchanged. It looks like we are not doing anything. You remain static. But the reality, we must also probably do small experiments. It's unchanged, but it remains at an acceptable level. Because if we don't use those ways, it creates certain things. Even if there's a regression, we must be able to say it's material. It's okay that it must be reflected as a regression. Is it material, substantive? If not, okay. Like you are saying in your response, it's not material. No one is going to die, but there must be an improvement. I think we should commend the department and the structures of oversight, including ourselves. We've kept them accountable, but there is always room, DG. You can't be getting very good 75% and your team get 38%. It means we need to give a carrot and a stick. Get those who are at the lower end to be paid. Yeah, thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Matlobo. And thank you to the Office of the Auditor General, just as you complete your last comment.
I think there's some answers that still need to be responded.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Yeah, there was a question relating to impairment on the auditor, AG's auditor's report. So what we do as an office is, for example, if you are a company and then you sell on credit, each year you need to do an assessment to see how much percentage do you think you'll recover what you've lent as credit. So that's based on past experience. So in this case, what we do now when we do the audit report, we just emphasize that on the audit report to say, public, we have this percentage which relates to this rent value of potentially irrecoverable debt. It's not saying that they won't be recovered, but it's just a prudent way of accounting to say, this is the amount that potentially we may not recover. So we just flag it in the audit report, but it's not cause for a panic, but it's just there.
Would you like to comment?
Yes, it's a pity Honourable Matlobo is leaving, because I wanted to...
leaving. No, Honourable Matlobo.
I mean, to respond to comment to his concerns. Just this.
Okay. But he's a member of this committee,
okay.
And he'll get the report.
Yes, because just to respond to, we have the same challenge when we assess these various levels of assurance providers. And to be honest, yes, it can get confusing and when you bring it back to reality. But the fact of the matter is, with the template that's given to you, you tick something and then it gives out the result. Therefore, even on the issue of materiality of the regression, or if you go to slide number 7, you'll see the fact that we say you're unchanged doesn't mean you don't have room for improvement. Even if when we say we're movement of 5% or less, that's where you get that orange arrow. So that doesn't mean you're 100%. There's always room for improvement. And a material regression, that's where you see a red arrow going down. So when you see an orange arrow going down, it means, yes, there was a regression, but it's not as bad as a red one. And if you look at the overall portfolio, there's not a lot of red arrows facing down.
No, thank you very much, Auditor General. We do need to conclude, but I'm taking the next hands, Honourable Flanguini, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Just a point of clarity on page 19, and maybe I was not here when that slide was gone through. Irregular expenditure, you say it's 40 million in the department. Is there a discretion of 40 million? And the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. I think just a point of clarity on that one. Maybe I could misunderstand the slide in total and stuff like that.
Thank you, Honourable Flanguini. Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. I have two requests and one explanation required. In terms of the false declaration and the name of the supplier, I think we would like to find out who that supplier is. And if that's not available now, please can we have it in due course. I think that's important. Secondly, I'd like an explanation because I just to understand it, without casting any aspersions, I just don't understand. I'd like explanation about the Durco accruals, actually. What does that mean? It's gibberish to me. Thirdly, to the Honourable Sanguini's point on the irregular and fruitless expenditure, can we get a detailed report, a written report, of exactly the breakdown of this? Because just to have a blanket amount is neither here nor there. If we can get our teeth into that, we gain better understanding. Thank you.
Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to say that we should commend the department for this report this outcome that they've got, because there has been steady improvement since I've been in this committee. And I must just say well done to the department, because you keep having these unqualified audit reports, which is fantastic. Thank you very much.
Right. I want to appeal to members on something here. The DTI will be addressing us, and there are two very pertinent questions that have come up here. On the one, this report on irregular expenditure, etc. And I think we should ask the DTI to provide that document. The Auditor General here is simply here to enable us to engage more effectively with the DTI. So if you don't mind, Honourable Kachalia, would you agree that we direct that to the department, that issue? Then with the Honourable Flanguini, a similar issue, but I do think to some extent the Auditor General's office could respond. Over to yourselves.
On the 40 million.
Okay, thanks, Chair and members. Okay, the 40 million, basically this slide, we're tracking irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and unauthorized expenditure over a period of 5 years, starting from 2013-14. So 2013-14, it was zero. If we look at the slide at the bottom, it was zero. And then we have that color, it's light blue or light, yeah, which is 40 million. It relates to 2014-15. It was the total irregular expenditure in 2014-15. And then in 15-16, it went to 17 million. And then in year 2016-17, it went to 11 million. And then in the current year, it was 7.6, which is documented as 8 million. And then we gave some high-level background of the entities contributing to that 7.6 million under that small notation, irregular expenditure contributors. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Does that address the issue, Honourable Flanguini? Thank you. All right. I would like to thank the Office of the Auditor General for assisting us in this regard with perhaps one suggestion. You know, whenever one is doing an analysis of something and evaluation, and you want to say 100% as well, tick, 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 there's always extra marks for innovation. What have you done beyond that point? And I see that the Auditor General, I have asked for this to be looked at before. Is there some other little colour you could include where the person achieved 100% on compliance, but actually taught you something, you know, created something else? And I think there is always, as you put it, even at 100%, room for improvement. Thank you very much to the Auditor General's office, Mr. Shabangu and Ms. Kamalo, as well as, I mustn't forget, Miss McAvoy. Oh, on this side, yes, thank you. And I hope you will remain behind as we engage with the DG and the Department of DTI. Over to you, please, Mr. October. Are you overhead already? Yes, you may need to change seats, I believe. Just do a little swap. Do you want to go and join your colleagues or whatever they really need to do to this slide? Okay. Right. Everyone here. And Honourable Kachalia, that will accompany the many issues that may be outstanding to come back from the department, so please remind us.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. I have been informed that brevity, by yourself, that brevity is the soul of all wit. So I will try to be as brief as possible and just proceed with the highlights in the presentation. As you are aware, the outline will be as before, and I think we are taking you through now for the fifth time, this is the last report for this administration, for the fifth administration. So we will again just give very briefly an economic overview. Then we will go into a summary then of the key findings. As you can see, there is a very thick annual report which has been distributed, so obviously I can only give a very, very high-level salary. And then, as I said, we'll go into the financial performance and deal with some of the issues you've raised. We would then like the committee to basically note and discuss the annual report, and then hopefully it will be approved. As you know, this annual report is done in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, specifically Section 40.
Yes?
Sorry, Chip, it's unparliamentary for people to come and stand in front of us and take photographs.
Yes, I normally point this out to the journalists. I didn't see you, so I apologize to the members. No, please, we're in session. I'm not sure when last you were in a court.
As I said, it's...
Sanguini?
No, it's not a problem to take the photos, Chair, but you must take off us too. We did do our makeup as well.
Actually, that is the whole point. We do it not because we don't want you to do your job, but we want to do our job. All right. But yes, thank you very much. And I noticed you certainly went into a sprint. Do continue, DG.
Thank you. As indicated, this report is done in terms of Section 40 of the PFMA. And as you know, we have to table our annual report within 5 months, which was done in August. And now we are presenting this. Chair, as I indicated, I'm not going to deal too much with the economic recovery, but let's just say the predictions was that there would be world economic growth will be improving to 3.9%. But of course, as you know, because of the rising protectionism and a potential slowdown in the global economy, the picture doesn't look as rosy as was predicted about the 3.9% global growth. And then, as I said, we are all very familiar with the domestic outlook and especially the latest quarterly results, so I'm not going to change that, but I want to just look at 2017 as a whole, because I think, as I said, we are constantly being quarterly reports and annual reports. So let's say for 2017 as a whole, as I said, the growth was positive but very low. And as I said, even though there was no contraction in 2017, as I said, the growth was insufficient to really create jobs or improve living standards. And we provide in the annual report a detailed report. But as you can see, this is where the problem of quarterly reports come in, because in the last quarter of 2017, we saw a massive expansion of the agricultural sector, where the agricultural sector grew by 17.7%, but then, as you know, because they raised the base in the following quarter, this growth was not sustained, and you're going to have again a big contraction in the agricultural sector. So therefore, I said sometimes quarterly reports are useful, but sometimes they obviously hide the broader trends, and it's sometimes important to look rather on an annual basis than on quarterly growth figures. But as you can see, there is a contraction in the final quarters of 2017. Similarly, as I said, there were lots of issues which distorted quarterly trade figures. There was Black Friday end of 2017, and then, as I said, we had a bumper agricultural harvest at the end of 2017, and so forth. So I'm not going to spend any more time in there. And then, simply put, in employment as well. As you can see, there's been we've had significant job losses, and as I said, that is reflected in our slow growth and in different sectors. But as I said, because the economy is, as I said, is now in a technical recession, but also overall in 2017 the growth was extremely low, this gives you then the performance of the manufacturing job losses. Let's just say the cause of all the job losses is low aggregate demand. All parts of the economy are not spending in this economy. Consumer spending is under pressure because of higher VAT prices, higher fuel prices, so consumers are constrained. But also government spending has declined, state-owned companies have declined in their spending, and then private sector, as we know, are not investing at the rate they should, and therefore, as you know, in terms of normal Keynesian economics, the drivers of growth, which could be government stepping in, but even government spending is declining. So there's low aggregate demand, and if you have low demand, the supply side suffers, and therefore you have factories running at 70-80% capacity and not at full capacity. And that's the real cause for our slow growth. But then we've had additional problems in our economy, especially the outbreak of listeriosis. And as we know, the three Tiger Brands companies had to be closed down. And we've had the drought in the Western Cape. And then also we had unfair competition and importing, and we've got the sugar issue later. But there's been a massive growth in, there's been a drop in the global price of sugar. There's been overproduction in major economies like India, and those products are being dumped on our markets, so it's affecting our sugar industry and so on. So I will then go very quickly again to the overall trade performance. As I said, our if you take the 2017 as a whole, or the whole financial year 2017-2018, we did again have a trade surplus. So our trade position is improving, but as I said, not on the scale which can raise employment levels. But at least we're out of the trade deficits which we used to have consistently. And again, obviously now the continent constitutes 1/3 of our exports. From almost zero in 1994, we have over 200 billion, 315 billion of exports to the continent. But of course, the big issue is this: we have massive trade imbalances with our neighbors on the continent. And as I said, that is why we have to adopt an investment-led approach. We have to both invest and export on the continent. Again, with the BRICS, again, whilst there's expansion in trade with our BRICS partners, and that's a welcome recovery in 2017, again, the trade is again structurally imbalanced. We export our raw materials to China, and we import to BRICS countries, and we import manufactured products. So diversification is needed in our BRICS export basket. And then, as I said, if you take it, we haven't diversified sufficiently. Even though there's been massive growth, you will see later in our exports of agro-processing products and export of motor vehicles, we are still have a negative manufacturing balance, and we are still reliant on our raw materials to drive our export basket. So I'll turn to the the department's performance and what is happening, what we've done in terms of the whole economy. As you know, the DTI has three goals, and I really repeat this all the time, but it's industrialization, transformation, and a fair regulatory environment. Those are our three core missions as a department, and we will report then along those lines. If we look at our core mission, which is the industrialization of the country, we can see that again, our hard work over the period in terms of building a very important sector, which constitutes the automotive industry, which constitutes 7.5% of GDP and employs over 500,000 people. We see there's been very good investment by all the OEMs now, the auto companies, Mercedes-Benz, Toyota, Volkswagen, BMW, Ford, and then we also have new players entering the market, Beijing Automotive Works and Isuzu, and you will see later on also Mahindra, the Indian OEM, is entering our market. So as I said, it's a broad-based performance and it's not confined to one or two companies. But also a very good revival in our footwear industry. So clothing, textile and footwear, as you know, we have saved this sector and we are now currently employs 95,000 people. So again, we have reversed the massive deindustrialization part which took place in the late 90s and early 2000s. So at least that is. Similarly, we are putting a lot of effort now in saving our metals industry and our National Foundry Technical Network. So a lot of been work, and there's an active program on our National Foundry work. Then I'll go very quickly then through the others, but as you know, we are trying to not only focus on our core sectors like clothing and textiles, autos, we also expanding into white goods and electronic goods sector, and as I said, that is work. We've seen expansion then by Whirlpool in Isitebe and KZN, and then also pharmaceutical sector in Limpopo, in Toyando. Secondly, we've got a program to develop the skills base of our boat building sector, and that program trained 134. We've also leverage on procurement, and therefore everyday cables. We've seen a big investment. As you know, there was big job losses in this sector before, but now we've seen because of new demand we've created through localizing the cables by Eskom, we've seen an investment by Aberdeen. Unfortunately, the last program has not delivered the results, but we were hoping to use the locomotive program to drive localization, but of course, because of the corruption in that program, we are not seeing all the benefits from that program. Then if we turn to other parts of thing which I won't mention much, but it's really, we launched key black industrialist programs for the year under review, six black industrialists in key sectors, automotive, micro finishing, in the pets industries, the Benza in Gauteng, and all joy in Limpopo. But again, you can see the black industrials are spread across the country. And then, of course, we've continued our work around our upgrade of our industrial parks program in Kolmani, in Dimbaza, and then there's 10 in total that we are working on. We're expanding that now to 26. Then if I turn to trade, I think, as I said, in summary on the industrial development side, we are really in the place of preservation and expansion in autos and preservation in the clothing and textile and agro-processing sector. If we turn to the trade front, as we indicated, our core focus is going to be intra-regional trade, expanding African trade, and here we signed up at to the tripartite trade agreement, and that process is close to now conclusion with East African Community and Egypt. And then secondly, we also will come into the quarterly report, but as you know, the work has shifted from the tripartite free trade agreement to the continental free trade agreement, which again, progress has been made, and we've signed that as well. And then, as you know, we run training programs to train people, companies to go on to to expand their export basket, and there it is the Global Exporter Passport Program, where we take small, medium companies and we make them export ready. So we've trained a total of 844 countries. We also obviously do our pavilions, and we won some best exhibitor awards. As you know, we assist companies by also providing them with strong trade leads so that they can see and spot export opportunities. The numbers are given there, and also there's been high-level engagements with the New Development Bank. And as you know, their basket was very small in terms of lending to South Africa and the continent, and that is set to grow. And you saw some recent announcements with the New Development Bank making quite a few investments now on the continent. Again, on the Special Economic Zones program, as you know, we will increase the number of investors under review. And as reported by the Deputy President yesterday in the National Assembly, our four operating SEZs, they've increased from 72 investments to 84. There's now 84 investments. Jobs have grown from 10,000 to over 13,000. So we're getting traction. But as I said, we still have some slower progress in the other SEZs because they're still doing the bulk infrastructure and so on. As I said, in total, there is an improvement in the SEZ. As you know, we are also building, we've now got 9 special economic zones. We train the officials of different provinces. We have trained 120 officials, and we also took an important road show where we took for the first time all our special economic zones, all of 9 of them, went to Guangzhou to show our wares in China, and as I said, we're already seeing some of the results. Chair, if I turn to transformation and black economic empowerment, as you know, BEE has 2 elements. The one is direct equity, and then what we give for foreign multinationals is what we call an equity equivalent, where they create suppliers or they do skills development programs. We have expanded this program, and 9 multinational companies have been approved. And as you will see recently, we've included Caterpillar, IBM, and a few other companies have been. There's over 100 students that we are being trained under this program in terms of skills development, and over 200 emerging companies are supported by foreign multinationals, and mainly, as I said, mainly US-based multinationals, but we are expanding it now to Asian, to Samsung is entering the program, and now we also have the German OEMs are joining the equity equivalent program, and we've created 3,000 jobs through the BEE equivalent program. We've also assisted our black industrialists to open up new markets, especially on the continent. We've taken them to Namibia, Uganda, and Mozambique, and this is part of the ongoing program of strengthening our black industrialists. Turning to legislation and regulation, which you've seen, we've issued the credit life insurance regulations. We've strengthened the zoning requirements in terms of liquor outlets. Again, as you see, we consistently have improved the issues around regulation of the gambling sector. We've convened the National Gambling and Liquor Policy Councils, and currently, as you know, you've got the bill before you, but that is arises out of those meetings. We're also putting increased focus on online gambling, which is the area where illegal gambling is growing. And then also, as you know, we need to modernize our legislation and digitization, and that was also done. If I then turn to administration and coordination, which is the final part. Again, as you know, when the AG reported, we have maintained our progress with regards to creditor payments. So again, all of our payments are done within 30 days, and still most of those payments are now done within 15 days. We've maintained that. We've also now, in terms of Malibongwe and promoting empowerment, women's empowerment, we are maintaining our record of over 51% in terms of women at senior management level.
and that will continue to improve. Our disability target has been exceeded. I won't go much into this, but you should be reminded that we did, we spent 99% of our budget, and as I said, when we assess our program, as I said, we've expended the maximum that we can spend. So if we're going to see, and especially this is the last report for this administration, but going forward, what we can say is that we're going to need, our budget was cut quite significantly, and especially for our incentive programs has been cut. We're now down to 9.3 billion. As you know, we were getting close to the 10 billion rand mark. Our budget is declining, so what we want to say is that if we're going to drive industrialization and transformation, this is an area of concern around the budget, but just to report that we don't have any criticism that we are spending the full amount of our budget every year. As you know, the bulk of our budget goes directly to the productive sectors of our economy. 58.9%, 5.4 billion is transferred directly to beneficiaries. We use it then in expanding production in the economy and creates jobs directly. And then, as I said, 17% is for operational expenditure. This again gives you an overview of our spending patterns. And as I said, we have consistently maintained where we now reach 1% underspending. Similarly, this shows the different parts of our budget and where the bulk goes. And as again, to remind you again, incentive development administration takes up 5.6 billion. And then industrial development takes up 1.8 billion. And those are our two biggest drivers. So as I said, our budget is now reflected of our core mission, which as I indicated is industrialization, and then followed by transformation, followed by fair regulations. And then, as I said, you've just gone through the audit outcomes. I'm not going to repeat that again, but as I said, thanks to the committee, and I really, as you can see, it is because of the hard time we got in our first year and first 2 years when we presented here. We have, over the past 4 years, received three clean audits since we were given that hard time. So I think it is, I must, on behalf of the DDI team, really thank this really hard-working and very, very committee for driving us to this report where we have maintained. As I said, we request that you note our annual report and that hopefully endorse the report. Siyabonga kakhulu. I'm going to go quickly to the first quarter report, which I think.
Still continuing?
It's going to be just... yeah. So as I said, I'm going to again maintain the brevity, and I'm not going to go... again, the only point I'm going to make, and as I said, I'm not going to talk to the quarterly figures, so that even though there is a contraction in the first quarter, which this is the first quarter of the financial year, which is April, June, July. So it's not the first quarter of the year. As you can see, there's a 2.2% decline in the quarterly figures, which, as you said, is worrying. But again, on an annual basis, and again, as I said, OECD uses annual figures. And there, as I said, the economy is, even though it is slight growth, 0.8%, it is still a worrying trend because it's not sufficient to deal with any of the challenges we face as a country. So I'm not going to go into detail, as I said, on this report, but again, the key drivers of this this technical recession and the second quarter of negative growth is, again, agriculture. Forestry and fishing fell by 24.2%. So there is an issue that we must, as I said, there is structural problems in the agricultural sector. And then again,
there is the issue of the mining sector dip as well, but then also there's a contraction in manufacturing. But as I said, every sector affects each other. All the, if there's a decline in agriculture, mining, then your entire economy goes down. And as I said, most of it is I'm not going to go into the reasons and maybe what you or some would call excuses for the poor economic performance. And I'm going to go straight into the key achievements for the first quarter. Again, as I said, we're trying to diversify the manufacturing more, so we're putting a lot of sector on pharmaceuticals and the broader chemical sector. So BioVac has upgraded their facilities to receive Good Manufacturing Practice Awards. Also, in terms of growing our medical device sector, that starts with putting in place proper regulations.
Yes, so just follow on there, it's slide 16, is it?
Yeah, okay, slide 16, we focusing on pharmaceutical sector. Also good progress, at least for a long time, in industrial participation. As I said, ARMSCoR is starting to spend money and through Project Biro in the defense sector. As you know, this sector has been in a decline for a long time, but we've seen Project Biro taking place, and therefore we've been able to sign 5 national industrial participation agreements. If you recall, for those, this is what there used to be the old arms deal program, but offset program. It's called industrial participation, but we've brought in some of the big multinationals now, and we're doing localization programs for them, Ford, Volkswagen, Mercedes, and Damon shipyards, because as you know, a big part of the ARMSCoR spending is on building new ships. And research vessels, especially in Simonstown and Durban. Then in terms of mining, we hope that there will be one more week left for the mining charter to be completed, but this this issue has created lots of uncertainty and dragged on an unnecessary long point of time. We have been advised that it will be finalized very, very shortly, and then it will go through the BEE process. As I said, the other area that we've been working on, we can report on for the quarter, is the gas industrialization. As you know, because of the large gas finds in Mozambique, and in terms of our regional industrialization, we've developed a clear program to use the gas industry to bolster growth. Also important announcement then in the quarter is Yekani. The minister launched this facility, which is a 28,000 square meter facility, a world-class, owned by a black industrialist in the East London Industrial Development Zone, created 1,000 jobs, and also making modern equipment ready for the fourth industrial revolution, tablets, laptops, and so on, mobile handsets, and so on. This shows what can be done under Black Industrialist Program. As I said, we're focusing on labor-intensive sectors, agro-processing, and there you can see we've made some significant progress with getting Tandy Wines and others to be able to sign up contracts with in China with regards to using our trade fairs. Similarly, Sidiba Beverages landed contracts in Botswana. Then this sector, as I said, has got special attention, which is metal fabrication and rail and transport equipment. There's been some restructuring. Whilst, as I said, this sector has suffered because of the lack of localization or the rollout of the locomotive program, but at least there's some restructuring taking place with the DCD. Naledi in Shlanganiso is a black industrialist as well, has done some expansion. Similarly, Transmash Holdings have brought on board a Russian and a black industrialist investor, that's work in that sector. In terms of incentive administration, our big job here is to roll out this agro-processing scheme, which, as you know, the minister launched that $1 billion program to focus on the sector, and we went on provincial workshops and roadshows to develop this sector, and we are now seeing some take-up in this program, which was slow initially. And turning to investment and exports, this is we can report then in the period We signed the African Continental Free Trade Area. As you know, there was big discussion, but we insisted as a country that we must go through proper legal processes and not just sign declarations for the sake of signing it. But we've gone through that process, and therefore the Ministers of Justice and Ministers of Trade and Industry signed off on that agreement, and then the President signed the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. We've also, as you know, next week there's going to be a big meeting with SACU. We finalized our position with regards to the SACU 2002 agreement, and as you know, it was dealt in the Finance Committee this week, but we are losing a lot of money in terms of the revenue from this scheme, but also we need to maintain our current trade policy stance, and therefore we've developed a clear position on where to take SACU, and that will be debated next week at the summit. We also, the President implemented this act, which you passed two or three years ago, the Protection of Investment Act, was signed off by the President. As I said, even though I think people have been calling this act certain names, but it's a very important act because it provides an extra level of protection to foreign investors, and especially given the current debate around land reform, and it's important that we signal to all investment that the investments are safe, and this this act provides that safety net. We've also we're close to concluding the discussions with the East African community, and then there's been work. We've also this issue, and again, this is going to be at the United Nations General Assembly, which is in about 2 weeks' time. African growth and opportunity. Even just this past week, we've had meetings with the United States, but we've had to define exactly what's going to happen with AGOA, because as you know, the US has imposed 10% tariff on aluminium and a 25% tariff on steel, and they are looking at autos. So we are losing a lot of the benefits of AGOA, even though, as you know, we made compromises with regards to allowing poultry import. So we had to provide to Cabinet a clear position, how do we see our relationship with the United States and going forward. So we are actively ensuring and engaging with the U.S. to maintain the benefits of the AGOA program, and that is the position we developed for Cabinet. Similarly, as you know, we are in the process of terminating our bilateral investment treaties because we've got an overarching investment act, and we've now reached agreement with China to terminate our bilateral investment treaty. And then we've also engaged in the Middle East, Qatar and Iran, and looked at how we're going to mitigate some of the effects of the United States pullout from Iran. And then investment pipeline, we launched the investment one-stop shop in Gauteng, so it's now in three provinces. Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng have the one-stop shops in addition to the national. Investment pipeline is healthy still. We've 27 billion has been invested. We are working now actively, and we put in place the program, and I think the summit will now be, or the investment summit will be at the end of October, and that is, as you know, the President has given us the task of raising 1.2 trillion. I think getting to conclusion then, we're continuing our work with World Bank to improve ease of doing business, and then very good investment here. As you know, Nissan has been sort of the laggard amongst our OEMs, but they are invested 1 billion in a new platform, and there are new investments coming from Nissan. Then also in the Northern Cape, as you know, there's always very low investment in Northern Cape, but Vedanta Resources, which is now sort of Indian-owned, has made a big investment in the Northern Cape in a smelter. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Mahindra, which is the new Indian OEM, has also entered our market now in terms of manufacturing. They're starting with completely knocked-down kits, CKBs, completely knocked-down kits, and that is situated in Dubai Trade Port. Turning to the SEZs, again, the new SEZs that was done in this period is Atlantis. As you know, we completed all the processes, all the technical work, all the public consultations, and
We are now in the really final stages of Kumasi. SEZ, so Mpumalanga will have their first special economic zone, and that is very, very far advanced. I think it's a sign-off stage. And we, as I said, we also did the investment roadshow in partnership with Bank of China. The other big one to announce is now in the papers recently, but this is the work which we did, which the President signed last week, but the work was done in the first quarter, which was the Musina Mokado SEZ in Limpopo is really finally taking off, and 10 investors, we've had intense engagement with them to start the investments, starting with a power plant in Limpopo and then metallurgical and beneficiation of coking coal in that area. We've continued our training of officials and we've relaunched the Black Empowerment Management Program. As I indicated, we are trying to put a lot of effort into the equity equivalent program by bringing in new players from Europe and Asia. And then finally, just to regulation, the big focus here has been on liquor, and as you know, we've run community awareness program because the liquor abuse and impact is becoming very serious, and we've done that roadshow, and we've also strengthened our National Liquor Authority with the online case management system. And then finally, turning to administration, I can report we've maintained our position, 52% women in senior management positions. Financial reporting, just to report, this is a quarterly update again. You will see a variance, which is 18% on slide 37. That variance is 18%. I think it shouldn't be too much concern because it is a quarterly and we will catch up because, as you know, with incentive payments, we can only pay to ensure if we have a clean audit that we have a proper B certificates. We've got we do site visits to ensure that the machinery is switched on. We need to do that, and as said, that sometimes we can't pay quick enough because those certificates and paperwork is not in order, and therefore there is that delay in paying of incentives. But we will deal with the underperformance in terms of the spending. As I said, there's big cuts and pressure on our budgets, but we're still in a comfortable position with regards to compensation of employees. And as I explained there, that's the incentive payments is the main cause of the for the underperformance, but it's outstanding compliance documentation which is the cause, and so on. Kerry Rocha.
Right, DDG. Thank you. That was really a marathon of information that you took us on, but at least the slides are very succinct and targeted. Now, I think, members, we're ready to engage. You notice the DDG did too. We're not dealing with sugar at the moment, so let's get that straight. I saw your hand, Honourable Kacharia. I saw the Honourable Mantash. I saw you, Honourable Ferson, and we got your apology. Who else on my left here? Honourable Buyani, in that order. Honourable Kacharia.
Thank you, Chair, and through you, thank you, DG, for the presentation. It's an impressive list of what you've done. My only measure of the success of what you've done is in terms of the contribution in overall terms, which is reflected in the quarterly figures and annual figures. Of course, it's a contribution in part because there are other factors, but in terms of the quarterly figures, it's down significantly, as you've indicated, and in terms of annualized figures, the plus factor is meager, to say the least. So an impressive list on one hand of actions and effect minimal, although the effect is not totally in your hands. I appreciate that. However, to address this and to allow this committee to be more cogent in its oversight and information. I'd like to make a reasonably formal request that in the future we get a, alongside the list of what was done, we have a reporting, formalized reporting of the bang for the buck, if you like, that we've got out of it in terms of return on investment across parameters such as jobs, sustainability, financial and otherwise, and cost. These are issues that we, these are parameters that we can then investigate and take a real view on. One would need to disaggregate the beneficiaries very clearly over time and look at their success, whether they've succeeded or failed and why, and also in terms of the meta interventions that you make as well. Now, if we could have that, then this committee could really cook. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Pacharya. Honourable Mantash. Members, can I appeal to everyone to focus on this? This is the department over which we exercise very rigorous oversight. It's our mandate. And I would appeal to all of us here to refrain from communicating on electronic devices. Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. We appreciate the report of the Department of Trade and Industry, Chairperson. And we applaud them for the clean audit that they received, because it means we have done good oversight, whereas they say we have remained unchanged in our performance. Don't know what that means. But Chairperson, I just have one general comment. Appreciating all the work that they have done, since this is the last report for the term, we know in South Africa that we export all our minerals. At which point are we going to establish foundries inside South Africa so that we can change the status quo? And this, I'm making it as a something that they take forward to the next term. Because we've been saying this throughout since 1994, but it has not changed 24 years down the line. We still export our minerals. At which point are we going to stop this? That's my main concern, Chairperson. We appreciate all the work done over time on trade and all the investments they've done in different areas. The SEZs, we're looking at their progress. The investments in our SEZs recently by the President in East London, we appreciate that. But as the Eastern Cape is in agricultural province, we used to have factories where the farmers sell their wool, but there's only one now. Are we putting all our hopes on the minerals? What about the agricultural province? Can we work towards changing the situation, Chairperson? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mantash. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much, and apologies, I was somewhat delayed. DG, the big question that I think that each department needs to be asking itself is, what role does it play in, one, rolling back the recession, and two, how has it contributed to the recession? And these are two important questions that I hope the DTI would ask itself. Because at the end of the day, the DTI plays a big role in driving exports, driving export promotion, and making it easy for companies to invest in this country. Now, what we know is that every year it appears that South Africa keeps going backwards in the ease of doing business report. It's easier to open a business in war-torn Afghanistan than it is to open a business in South Africa. Now, that can't be right. It can't be easier to open a business in some of our competitive countries than it is in South Africa. And what we do is we have a tendency to blame everyone else and everything else. So let's look at what contributes towards the recession. We know it's uncertainty. We exist in an uncertain time. But we also know things like red tape contribute massively. And I've just come from a meeting this morning with the deputy or the assistant secretary for US Commerce. And he told me he met with you not a couple of days ago. And one of the big chief concerns for American companies is the NRCS and LOA. And we can't seem to deal with a situation like that. It keeps going on every single year, the same situation. We still don't have a long-term view on incentives, DG. We still can't put a 5-10-year plan together for MCEP, despite us continuously talking about it as a committee. What are we doing on that basis? And then with respect to AGOA, I think that the diagnosis is somewhat misplaced, because actually the biggest threat to South Africa's continued participation in AGOA is the case before the courts with respect to chicken quotas. Because if the court agrees with the applicants, that would be an automatic exclusion for AGOA for us. So we have a lot of problems on the horizon. And I think that the one way that we can beat recession in this country, well, that's if some of us actually agree that there is a recession. It appears some politicians don't actually think that we're in a recession. But we need to make it easier for people to invest in this country.
Moment, Honourable MacPherson, I don't like interrupting people on the floor, Honourable McLaughlin.
We also don't want interrupting people, Comrade Chair. But if Honourable MacPherson wants to discuss a substantive issue like recession, we all do have views. And what is the subject matter on the table? We need just that guidance. If we're all going to be opening up about matters that are brought around trade and industry, we have the capacity to do so, but there are rules on how we need to do them. I'm just raising my hand for guidance. Because there is a business,
right.
The business is a quarterly report.
Sorry, I know.
On the thing that have been presented here, Chair.
Right.
That's why I'm asking for guidance.
Well, the reason I allowed it is that the DG himself referred to the recession and the impact.
Sorry, maybe
but,
things were wrong.
No, may I finish?
Yes.
But will you continue, Honourable MacPherson, that on perhaps deeper issues, you know what can be done. Continue with this engagement.
Sure, maybe the conversations in the cabinet were not as detailed as this and were more shallow, but hopefully in time...
Just refrain from that.
We'll get to the Honourable Schlobel will adjust to life. So I think that what we need to do, DG, is look at how do we drive investment into our country, into these SEZs. We know what the investors are telling us are the problems to that. So I really would ask that yourself at some point can diagnose what the DTI believes that, you know, three or four sort of urgent interventions to try and roll back the recession, how we are contributing to the recession, and I'd really like to see that report and see how this committee can then assist your department to make those changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. We had on my left here, I think, the Honourable Buyani.
Chair, thanks. Mine is just a clarifying question. Let me first welcome the report and also double check man in terms of the manufacturing decline from the Tiger Brands draft in Western Cape and also the sugar production, given the SASA situation. I wanted to check whether the DG has a plan in trying to resuscitate the situation, given the situation in the Western Cape in terms of the drought and also the sugar production. That will be one. Then the second one is in terms of the industrial development. I can see the mandate is to promote industrial development, investment, competitiveness, and employment creation. Then I wanted to take in terms of the facilitation of transformation, whether both building sector, procurement, and the locomotive center, and in terms of the training, do we have any localization? Maybe the black industrialists, how many blacks? Because we don't have, in fact, the percentage as to all this program. Because we are here representing the masses, we must be able to double check as to where are we in terms of the transformation, whether blacks are part of the industry, the BE, in terms of localization, and also in terms of the agro processing. And the last one, the incentives. At the previous disadvantage, benefiting in the incentives, and how and in which sector. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Buyani. Was there another hand? No. I think, DG, the point you made about demand and supply in our economy is highly relevant for all of us. Yes, we had all these production sites, etc., could produce, but the demand was not there. How do we increase this, you know, the demand? Otherwise, the supply, the private sector, if you like, would have to close down. Now, that would appear to be have been the case in some instances. I was a little concerned about the Tiger Foods and the reference to three production plants, and clearly nothing to do with supply and demand. And I was under the impression that they had been asked to close down temporarily to, as it were, clean up the operation. Now, if indeed you are aware of any reasons around that, it would be very useful to hear. The other area that one was somewhat concerned about was the BRICS issue. And it would have been very interesting to hear, you made a reference on page 23 that, you know, the BRICS summit provided hope to both South Africa and Russia to benefit from measures aimed at rebalancing trade. Now, I think it would be quite constructive for us to hear a little bit more about it. When it comes to the AGOA issue, of course, everyone is concerned about AGOA, both in the public and the private sector. But it would help if we got some further clarification. You made a reference in your presentation to something like a 25% tariff on steel or whatever, and that really impacting negatively on us as a country. Now, in relationship to the poultry question that the Honourable Macpherson put on the table, what are we looking at when we look at the one side, if you like, the manufacturing side, the raw metals side, primary metals, and the poultry itself? Where are we in relation to that, with perhaps the loss of jobs here, considering that steel has a very, very significant value chain as well? So it would be helpful if we could get a better understanding of that. And lest I also begin to exceed my 2 minutes, let me stop. Not quite. Over to you, DG.
Chair, if you don't mind, if I could deal with the issue you've raised, actually, because it is so relevant now, and as Honourable Macpherson has also met, but the U.S. Commerce Department is in the country, and as you know, we need to build allies now because of the actions of the White House. So, but if we just turn to the other issue you raised about Tiger Brands, as you said, when the listeriosis was discovered, when they traced it to the Tiger Brands facility and the Rainbow Chicken facility, our Consumer Commission, which must be really congratulated, they acted within 4 hours of the findings,
and then they issue the notices for, as you know, for the bologna and for processed meat products to be withdrawn from the retailers, and then for those plants to be closed down. Now, that was done. As I said, unfortunately, the response from RCL was much quicker and much better than Tiger Brands. They immediately upgraded their facilities, brought in food inspectors, and that plant is now back on stream from RCL. Unfortunately, the situation was worse at Tiger Brands. And as you know, this is the problem of deregulation. Tiger Brands has been one of the ones who are fighting. As you know, we don't have a compulsory standard for processed foods. We were supposed to develop the standards, but we had strong pushback from the food industry to deregulate. And that is why we had the problem. Fortunately, we can report, as you know, last week, the Minister of Health closed that we've completely solved the problem of listeriosis. There's no more listeriosis in our food chain. But we've also issued clear regulations now. And we're busy increasing our amount of inspectors. We're working with the Department of Health and municipalities. But as I said, once Tiger Brands now properly regulates its safety standards, they will come back on stream. But unfortunately, this, what I recovered was the quarterly report. And we have been working, as I said, over the past few weeks very intensely on revitalizing the work. And then, as you say, on the poultry issue, as raised by Honourable McPherson, the poultry industry has gone to court. They want to set aside the entire AGOA agreement. And as you know, which will have dire consequences. Because, as you know, our strategy has always been, and we did succeed then, in extending AGOA for 10 years. But because AGOA, we needed to make some compromises, as you have to do if you deal in trade relationships. We needed to compromise, and the compromise we offered was one which was we allowed in the 60,000 tons of poultry. What the Poultry Association is arguing is that the U.S. have reneged on the agreement by putting in place the tariffs. But as I said, the response to that, we've raised it with the U.S. and we've told them that actually South Africa is absolutely no threat to the U.S. There's a principle in international trade called de minimis rule, which means if your exports or imports are less than 5%, you usually get excluded from anti-dumping actions. And our exports to the U.S. is so minuscule. We have no negative effect on the economy, so we cannot understand why are they punishing us and they allow Brazil and South Korea to export to them. So we're making our case, but as I said, we mustn't enter into a confrontation. We will all be losers if we lose AGOA. So we are trying to emphasize that and trying to... So we will be explaining to the court the importance of AGOA and that we think that, that still the balance of benefit is still in South Africa's favor if we maintain AGOA and so on. So I don't know if there's an addition, and then I'll turn to...
Can we not allow the DG to complete, please, Honourable McPherson? Yeah, I am giving you a lot of latitude. Go ahead.
Thanks, DG. I'm really, really encouraged to hear that. Can you just confirm that you will, are you applying to be a friend of the court, or are you just submitting, or are you a respondent?
What we will do is what will be similar to amicus curiae, which is a friend of the court. Which we will abide the decision of the court, so that we pay respect to the judiciary, but we will bring all the facts to the attention of the court, which will show the fine balances we need to reach, and that a AGOA still on balance is good for South Africa. Then, turning to Honourable Kachalia's point, I think I'm going to, you're right, what we have done separately, and I'll ask... our Deputy Director General, Malebo, to give you that. But what we've done is, in terms of all our incentives, looking at the impact assessment, and there is a report which we have published, but I will hand over to that. But you're right, that is the nub of the problem. We need to show what we've achieved, and then, as I said, because to the other point, we need to then develop, hopefully for the next administration, a five-year plan, where we can get five-year commitment on incentives.
and it is not subject to reduction as it has happened to us now. And then Honourable Mantash, so as I said, Malebo will deal with the issue of the performance of the beneficiaries and in Honourable Kacharya's question as well. I think I'll deal with the issue of the overall recession in one answer. But Honourable Mantash, I think you've probably raised the critical issue that we've been speaking about beneficiation for a long time, and we stay in the structural problem of a lack of diversification and so on. The real, as I said, the real problem we face as a country, why we can't beneficiate, is because of the low levels of demand in our economy. So if you, as I said, because of our legacy, and I was explaining it to the US as well, because our markets are so small on the continent, 1 billion people has been divided into 50 countries. So none of our markets are big enough to industrialize and to beneficiate. And as you know, in all other countries, what they've done is, if they do have small economies like Sweden, Sweden is only 10 million people, but they're fully industrialized. The reason is they export into the whole European Union, which is 500 million people with high incomes. So you create demand, and you see supply can't drive demand, because all you do is if you just push up supply, all you do is you flood the market, you reduce prices. But that's why Keynes's major contribution was to say what drives an economy is demand. And what drives demand is the income levels of your population and government expenditure. Now, unfortunately, in our country, we face with two problems. The one is because of exclusion of 90% of the population, demand is very low. And also, people are still trying to suppress wage levels. We think that if we resist wage increases from employees, we're doing good for the economy, but we're actually harming the economy. Because as you saw from your Germany report, unions have always been raising wages, which means there's high levels of aggregate demand in those economies, and high aggregate demand drives aggregate supply and industrialization. So to Honorable McPherson's point as well, the reason for our investors, as I said, our investors are coming here, but their factories are running at, ABB, for example, produce transformers. Their factories running at 50% capacity. So all our investments have come, as I said, we've got 78 new in the special economic zones. The problem is demand is not there. Construction industry has been 2 years in recession, and we've got a world-class construction industry. We build all over the world, but Marion Roberts and Group 5 goes into liquidation because there's no big infrastructure projects which is driving. The SOE spending program has collapsed. Consumers are not buying. Even AVI earnings are down. Clover's earnings are down because, as I said, people are under pressure because of fuel prices, VAT, and so on. So our key demand, and that is why I'm saying it doesn't depend on the political cycle. It doesn't mean on anything. It's a structural problem about low levels of aggregate demand, and it's partly exclusionary, and that is why all other countries have big regional markets. And we, that's why the continental free trade area, but even then, even the African continent suffers the same problem, these low levels of demand, and its complete reliance on oil if driving demand. So I think that is the key problem for our low beneficiation and for our problem of these goals. Of course, it was added to in South Africa because of the droughts and so on. Then I think, again, Honourable McPherson, the issue of NRCS, it was raised by the US as well. We have told them that we are, as I said, we've reversed the backlog at National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications. And as you know, there it's not a question of demand, it's a question of we deal with imports. So, and as you know, we also deal with they're moving to what has been called the risk-based system, and that we've given some comfort to the United States that because we'll be developing a risk-based system, what we will do, because we have to have 120 days timelines, what we've said is where people have strong regulatory systems and they give us the mutual assurance that those products will be
of a high quality and will not be problems. We will fast track those ones and we will focus, and they will, they're actually going to, they've done it in the US, they've got apparently a complex system where they allow fast tracking of certain products, and then they focus their customs officials on those problems which are from high risk area. Unfortunately, the US is obviously, as you can know, the biggest problem was the Cougar vehicle, which is US. So it's not also, it doesn't necessarily mean that. And as you know, chicken, poultry, the worst poultry with the lowest standards comes from the US. But at least we know on the electronic products, the ICT, we know there that the US has very high standards. So we hopefully we will be addressing, I can give the committee and to solve the NRCS issue very shortly. As I said, we a long-term view on incentives, I think we will definitely welcome that, and that is the lesson for the next administration, is that if we can have five-year plans for incentives, but also as we're doing in the auto industry, we're busy finalizing the MIDPs, APDPs coming to an end in 2020. We are 99% of the way of finalizing a auto program till 2035. And then we will go to, and Honourable Chair, I must say that there is really positive developments here where we're going to get some massive jobs in this industry. But it's because we're going to move to 1 million vehicles in automotives. And then that is on track. I think Honourable Mabiani, we will go into a bit more detail, but I think I'll also ask the DDG to deal with the incentives you raise and also BEE participation. But let's say it has always been a lagging issue. There's been low levels of black participation in our incentive programs. 90% of them has gone to established companies, but because of our new programs we're introducing, and also we are introducing BEE levels, that you must have a certain BEE level to comply. That is having an impact, but DDG Incentive Administration will deal with that one. We will deal with the sugar issue as well when we come to that one, if you don't mind. Localization has worked in sectors where, for example, the buses. As you know, my city, Riaga, Arieng, all of them have bought local, and it's black industrialists that are benefiting from building our buses. But as you know, but when you have corruption, like in the Transnet one, you have factories standing empty and black industrialists going bankrupt in liquidation because of a lack of implementation of the localization one. But it can work. We've shown it in the bus industry and in the other, in clothing and textile, it has worked. We've managed to have 95,000 jobs saved because people are buying clothing. Police, army, all of them are buying local. And so I've dealt with the issue. I'll just hand over to Malib.
Thanks, DG Chair and members. I think on the incentives and their performance, Chair, you recall that on an annual basis, we produce an incentive performance report, which we were advised that has been tabled to Parliament. And then that report details the exact performance. It looks at what we've done as far as job creation is concerned, localization and black economic empowerment. Just on black economic empowerment, all our incentives, of all our incentive recipients, I think this is the year that we've created a record high of level 4 triple BEE and above recipient approvals. So we've got up to 70% of our approvals are sitting at level 4 triple BEE and above, and then we've got 25% of those who are at 25 at level 1 triple BEE. So this is what DG is talking about, that because of the new programs, the one in agro-processing, the Black Industrialist program, and the requirement that is put across all incentives that you must have a BEE level, we've increased participation of Black South South Africans in the transactions that we have supported. And our largest contingent liability, our largest area of incentive growth going forward is the Black Industrialist Program. That's what has changed the stats. So next year when we come, we will find that it will be closer in terms of numbers to around 90% of those that the Department of Trade and Industry has supported being black companies. We're also now tracking even women, how we are doing on women in the manufacturing sector and those that are export ready. And where we are, we standing now, it's not where we would like to be. We're still under 20%, but we're looking for ways to get it over. But from the export readiness program, we're looking at around 50% of women that we have assisted for export market research. And then from investment, because that was another indicator that was requested, that is leveraged from the monies that we also put into the economy. For every one rand that the DETI contributes, we are now reaching levels of around 5 rand, just based on some of the sectors that we are supporting. At minimum, for every one rand, we will get investment of 3 rand. So it's from 3 rand up until 5 rand, and some even exceed that. We also, in terms of jobs, track the numbers of jobs that we have supported. In the last financial year, we were looking at least in terms of direct jobs that we can go to a company and count. We're looking at no less than 70,000. And we know that our economic models tells us that if we're looking at 70,000 in terms of indirect and reduced, you're looking at least double that for the indirect jobs. That means if there is a factory, there'll be somebody selling magwinya, there'll be somebody selling something around the factory. Those create jobs. And they will also be procuring from somewhere else in order for them to run their businesses. So if we talk roughly 70, we could literally be going more into the 200 up to even a million, just based on an initial investment that was made. And then, of course, the report talks to provincial spread as well. And what we are seeing, although not to the extent that we would like, is that the provincial spread is slightly changing. We're starting to see provinces that previously didn't participate now participating. Provinces like Limpopo, where in the previous financial year we were able to support more companies than we've ever supported before in Limpopo, in Mpumalanga, and in the Free State. It was the first year that we were able to increase participation to much more than we've done before. But the report itself has been tabled, and I think when you have the time, we will be ready to come and present it formally. Thank you.
This was the DDG, Abichi Thompson, of the Incentive Administration and Development Division. Thank you. You still responding, DG?
I wanted to one final response on ease of doing business. As you know, that's always a work in progress, and Invest SA is working with the World Bank, where we're working with municipalities and provinces, and we have I reported in the quarterly report, we're working actively to make all levels of government the ease of doing business. But as I said, on the question of the opening of business, that problem is solved now. CIPC's got second year clean audit in a row. It takes 15 minutes to open a company in South Africa. And as you know, the problem is not the number of companies. I think we've got 5 million companies on the CIPC database. The problem is 90% of those companies are owned by black South Africans, and they can't even enter the trading market. The problem is its demand. And as you saw in Germany, big companies buy from small companies.
In South Africa, big companies only buy from big companies. So ShopRite Checkers only buys from Unilever and Tiger Brands. We, at our township business summit, the black companies were complaining that they can't enter these supply chains. So the problem is you register your company with CIPC, but you never trade. Because so that is our biggest problem. It's not the ease of starting a company. It's the demand again. But there's demand internally. So what we're saying is, like we've done in clothing and textile, we should raise the point where retailers must buy local as well, not only government. That way you stimulate demand. But as you can see on our shelves, lots of products which can be bought locally. So we need to think about in the going forward a more aggressive stance, and maybe we should follow President Trump, because he's very, this is the one thing he's very good at. He's forced America to buy local again.
No, thank you, DG. I do have two follow-up questions, and I see a third one was added, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Buyani to start with, Honourable Williams, Honourable Sanguini, Honourable Kachalia, Honourable McPherson. Members, because this is our mandate, our focus, we are going to allow a little bit more time, because effectively, we should be finished in 5 minutes, but we're not going to do that. We will continue.
Yeah, Chair, thanks. Maybe this is the last one from my side. I just wanted to check with the DG, because the report here, it tells us that the NCR, the NCC, and the NCRS, they are in serious trouble. So I'm not so sure. We just request the DG to come close to this space, because really, if you see that there's irregular expenditure of 3.4 million, 3,696,96, it's a problem. So we request the DG to come close to these entities, so that we see how can you assist as a portfolio. And also welcome, we can see that there's 52% of SMS. I just learned that the SMS is senior management employment, because in terms of the organogram now, in senior employment is 52% of women, and that is very much acceptable. We welcome that as a portfolio committee. Chair, the last one is the question of DECO accruals. That is not clarified. Can the DG go back to that and then clarify? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Buyani. Honourable, I thought it was Williams, yes, earlier. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I just want to continue on. Honourable Mantosh said, you know, we've got a problem with industrialisation. When are we going to do it? And the DG responded by saying there's no local demand. But in just at the end of his last input, he said, perhaps we should go the US way, where the private sector has been forced to buy locally. Now, I just want to know, the last time we raised this, we were told by your department that we can't go that way because of the WTO. So now, is it realistic? Can we go that way? Or, you know, how does it work? Does the US not really care about the WTO? And if not, can we also not care about the WTO and put our best interest first? I mean, what is the situation here? How far can we go before, I don't know, we become Donald Trump's attitude? Thank you.
Right. Not that we want to go that route, I'm sure. Honourable Sanguini.
Thanks, Chair. Mine is just on page 19, Chair, for sake of interest. Just like to know, who's the owners of Tandy Wines? And then, yeah, Tandy Wines. I would just like to know who's the owners of that. So they mustn't expropriate our names in the sake of getting black names, and then the whole company is owned by, yeah. But nevertheless, on the other hand...
Honourable Sanguini, you are still on the floor.
Thank you, Chair, for the protection. And then also on the other hand, I just like to, in terms of interest, how do you Because I was listening to the DG in terms of when she was explaining about the number of jobs and things like that. How do you track your imports as a department? How do you monitor that, your imports and stuff like that on these companies? That you are strict that they, in terms, they follow to the T, South African regulation and stuff like that. I just like to know for interest's sake, how do you monitor that? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Langwini. Honourable Kachalia.
Thank you, Chair. I have a number of points to raise in no particular order. On AGOA, which we spoke about earlier, and the importance of it to us, Section 104 of AGOA requires sub-Saharan African countries to have a commitment to the protection of private property. I'd be interested in how you're addressing this. Section 104 of AGOA requires sub-Saharan countries to commit to protecting private property. And in view of what's happening in our political domain, I'd be interested in how you as a department are giving the requisite assurances in this very important area. Secondly, yesterday we had the NRCS before us, and you said that you're glad that they're making progress and you're looking into it. I brought to their attention, and I bring to your attention, that in their 2014 report they said that letters of authority took 120 days for them to deal with in 2014. In their 2018 report, letters of authority took 120 days to deal with. No progress. Zero, nada, tololo. So I think we need to deal with that. And then in terms of the incentive report, which thank you for answering that. I'm less interested into the provincial spread or how we tick boxes in terms of women and BE, because I'm sure that's done. What I'm specifically interested is in the sustainability of these incentives and businesses that we have in terms of their profitability and in terms of the jobs. Now, you do report on jobs, but jobs are dependent on sustainability and profitability. Those are the key metrics, and those need to be reported on an annualized and regular basis so that we can interrogate that. And finally, just a warning on the Trump wish that we force people to buy locally, because that I warn that will just entrench non-competitiveness if we go down that route.
Thank you, Honourable Kachalia. Right, Honourable Mantash, followed by the Honourable MacPherson.
Chair, just a question for interest. On slide 24, the DG said they have an agreement with China to terminate the bilateral investment treaty. And my question of interest would be, what can we expect in the new treaty that is going to be negotiated? What are the issues? And what is it really, in their view, that South Africa benefits to the maximum in the BRICS arrangement, especially with Russia? Is it a political arrangement, or does it assist us in investments? What is this relationship? I just want to ask that, because at some point my lecturer in UJ says, and I want to hear it from the teacher, he says, really there's nothing for South Africa in the BRICS arrangement, to the extent that even if you write that BRICS weight, South Africa is written in a small letter because it doesn't contribute. Do we really benefit, or is that we give all to the BRICS partners? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you. Just to go on about driving demand. I mean, there's two ways that you can drive demand. And I just want to focus on the state's ability to drive demand. So we know, DG, that the state is the biggest procurer of goods and services in this country, and yet repeatedly they refuse to comply with local procurement. They find any and every reason not to support local businesses. And I've said this before in this committee, and I've said it to you. You go to any local municipality, and they don't buy from local businesses. You look at the tracksuits that they buy, the T-shirts, everything. All is imported from China. And so, you know, I ask, how do we say to the private sector that we would like them to support the local sector, but government does not do so? Again, this week, I have found of a municipality that has gone and bought aerial platforms for their fleet from a dealer who will have them made in Italy and imported into South Africa when they aerial platforms, you know, that they put on to deal with electricity poles and that sort of thing like that. They will buy it from an Isuzu dealer in South Africa who will have the platforms made in Italy and then assembled here in South Africa, despite that is available in this country.
Sorry, Honourable MacPherson, the name of the municipality.
No, I will deal with it directly with the...
because you raised it in committee.
But it was given to me in confidence, so I will deal directly with it.
Well, then, I have a problem with that. This is a committee meeting,
yeah.
And we have a policy on localisation,
yes.
And we have called for the reports of all these municipalities, which have been provided before, and they will be provided in this committee. So for someone to say that's confidential, we don't want the person's name. We're looking for the name of the municipality.
I'll give it to you directly, DG. And so, I mean, I think that we really need to...
Honourable members, Honourable Montash.
Chairperson, we feel uncomfortable when the chairperson of the portfolio committee is being, or his authority is being undermined by a member. Can Honourable MacPherson comply with what you're asking him to do?
Asked for the name of the municipality. This is a committee meeting.
And as I said, I will give it directly to the DG because it was done in confidence. And there's nothing to...
No,
force.
I don't accept
no,
that.
Well, there's nothing... You can't force me to disclose information. So.
No, you're quite right. I can't force
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And I don't intend trying strong-arm tactics. Please turn your mic off. Honourable Ms. Lawball.
Sorry, I'm not finished.
You to turn your mic off.
I'm not finished, Chair.
Well, I have asked you to finish.
But I'm not finished.
Honourable MacPherson.
Can I finish?
No.
So
you can finish after this. You may continue afterwards.
After what?
After I've heard what the Honourable Ms. Lawball has to say.
What, is it a point of order?
No, I don't take points of order.
Sorry, I'm... Sorry, I'm just trying to understand.
Hear what the Honourable Ms. Lawball says. I have not myself said you undermining me, but the reality is this is a committee meeting, and therefore our policy is that we get the names of all public institutions. The municipalities are the third sphere of government.
So where's that policy?
Why don't you look it up, please?
Well, can you provide it to me?
Now, I'm not going into a dialogue.
So it doesn't...
Honourable MacPherson, I asked you to stop speaking at this moment because I wanted to hear the Honourable Matlobo. I will come back to the other matter which I have requested for the committee. Honourable Matlobo.
Well, no, thanks, Honourable Comrade Chair. I think we should be able to respect the rules or the authority of the chair. And it will be very problematic when some people they speak, we don't speak. And then it's our turn, they start disrupting. We don't want to stoop to that level. When the chair, we have spoken. And if people are not happy with your ruling, there is a mechanism that is provided. That's what I'm actually rising on. The last part is to say when we are done with your list, I want to be put into your list. But I was just making an appeal to say you might not agree with the chair, but there are balance and checks to say if you have a disagreement with the ruling of the chair without actually reducing the work we do to what we're trying to do now. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Until we get the name of that municipality in the committee, please stop that line of questioning. You may continue.
Thank you. So that was a point of order then. Will you entertain it? So I want to know, you know, at the end of the day, DG, how are we dealing with this constant non-compliance to drive local demand through the state? And then, I mean, secondly, through driving demand in the private sector, I mean, as far as I'm aware, there's nothing that allows us to force, local retailers to buy from local manufacturers. I mean, in that space, however, I think that we can offer people, you know, incentives or opportunities to support local manufacturers. Which leads me on to a very scary statistic that I saw the other day, that 50% of all self-employed businesses have closed in the last 5 years. So people who had their own business working for themselves have closed over the last 5 years. And that's, I mean, there's a number of reasons. It could be that it just simply didn't work out. But what I'm beginning to see is in BEE transactions or BEE, the scorecard, how there is less and less focus being paid to supplier development, which is where we should see the emergence of small-scale black businesses emerging into the market. And it's a big, big concern for me. What are your views on that, and how are we trying to address it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Langwini.
Sorry, Chair, to take the meeting on another level, but I just want to announce that Advocate Darlene Povo is in Nelson Mandela, and as far as I heard, the court case is going very well in Nelson Mandela.
It's sort of an announcement, thank you. Can we turn to the DG? Let's get on with the substantive issues that are before us, DG.
Comrade Chair, I did make the request to include me before the DG responded.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I lost track then.
No. Thanks, Chair. Mine is probably a request, you know. Maybe because I'm a late comer, I'm struggling. I'm not one of the fastest people who can catch things. But there are fundamental issues, Chair, that have been raised. And my view is that probably there are important issues, but we need to give ourselves quality time rather than to be choosy and picky so that some of us can participate. For an example, there are issues that have been raised around the benefits of some of the trade agreements. Why don't we probably request that we have a full brief on certain critical trade agreements, especially the AGOA one, Comrade Chair. Remember now, the change in the trade relations and the emergence of protectionism and the impact that is being made. And it becomes much easier if there is a data that is there and we all have the same data so that we can be able to say what is the way forward. For an example, we know that our contribution, especially around the steel in the U.S., is very minuscule. It's even less than a percentage. But an important decision has been made. South Africa were not actually getting the exemptions, while others are being given the exemption. And what is going to be the essence of the WTO? And remember, the WTO negotiations have been long coming. Certain resolutions are not being made. And it's one example I'm just making. For an example, there are other trade relations, like with the EU. EU just made a decision that they are coming to Africa now. We know that there is economics and politics in between, because everybody knows that was a growth point. Everybody runs here, and including the Prime Minister of Britain, who's starting to run here. And how do we actually do these things that Africa's interest as a bloc and the interest of South Africa and SADC? And we discuss in a more structured way with certain statistics, because we could see members are using more statistics and they're not even disclosing what is the source of statistics. Example, Honorable McPherson is talking about 50% of certain entities over the last 5 years. It becomes a little bit difficult if we speak in the air. But the issue around the industrialization is an important question. Are the incentives going to the right areas that sit, one, to ameliorate the condition in which our people find them in? Are the incentives in the right sectors of our economy? But I would welcome that this report comes here so that our interventions become more pinpointed. It's not a question, but it's an appeal to the committee so that we will also be able to use our own kind of capabilities to say, is the country on track? And if we give criticism, and the criticisms must be fair. That's why you might be shocked why this comrade is quiet today. But I feel there are important issues, but the committee, if it can find a mechanism that these important matters of national interest will make time, because they are views we have, especially from our constituency.
Thank you very much, Honourable McLaubo. Perhaps I should have mentioned it earlier in the week, but it was referred to by DEG Mabichi Thompson, and that is the annual incentive report. We said at the beginning of this year, when we were told it will be coming towards this time, that we would make space in our program. So I just emphasize that to yourself, Mr. Madima, not this minute, but that we need to look at the program, and it's a very important annual report. And I would really propose that issues around that may be responded to in detail in that meeting. But if you would respond to the other issues raised in this regard by the committee, DG.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks for the questions. I'm going to hand over to our CFO to maybe just deal with the accruals and the issue of Honourable Mabuyan.
Thanks, DG, and good afternoon to the Honourable Members and the Chairperson. Chair, if you do allow me, I think there was one or two questions around the AG report, if I can maybe just clarify and provide some context to it. The first one around the DRCA accruals. The DTI has a footprint in approximately 40 foreign offices. And in each of those offices, the DTI has appointed a foreign economic representative that deals with all trade and investment matters. And in And the agreement that we have is, instead of duplicating functions within those offices with DERCO, we've got an agreement with DERCO that they provide an administrative support to this foreign economic representative in those offices. And the reason why it's called an accrual is it's its name after DERCO, because they're providing that support. But they actually will make payments to any suppliers or for any goods and services in those countries, and actually claim it back from the DTI through an interdepartmental process. And the reason why it's called a DERCO accrual is because there is quite a diplomatic process that needs to happen. I mean, those vouchers, when they need to provide it to DTI for reimbursement, it comes through diplomatic mail, and then it takes maybe like a month or two, but then it comes to DERCO head office, and between DERCO head office and DTI, we then clear this and settle this interdepartmental claim. So that's the reason, that's why it's called this DERCO accrual. The other question, maybe just to provide some clarity, the AG reported a finding around a supplier who provided, I think the word they use is false declaration of interest. Now, what the Public Service Act, and the Public Service Act is very clear, is that a state official cannot do business with the state. Okay? So this is where the finding has arose. So what the Auditor General has found is that there is an official in the broader government that has done business with the state. What the procurement laws require, that when you do business with the state, you need to make a declaration that your company does not have any officials that are employed by the state doing business. So when that company provided a declaration to DTI, they said they had no officials actually employed by the state. Only to find, when the Auditor General reported, that there was an official who belonged to another government agency and actually did work with the state. We have taken the finding on board, and we have written to that agency. We have received feedback as well, because the audit process was finalized. We have written to them, and they will be investigating the matter further with the possibility of actually dismissing that official. So maybe that, to provide that context and clarity.
Thanks, that deals with that. And then your further question, Honorable Boyani, is yes, definitely, as you said, we are paying particular attention to NRCS, SABS, and also NLC as well. As you know, over the years, and I think as we come to the end of the administration, we have 12, 13 agencies reporting to the DTI. And as you know, all of our problems have actually happened in the agencies in terms of corruption and problems and maladministration. So we have been cleaning up the agencies, and as I said, our last one, as I said, the process, as I said, with NCR, as I said, we're in the final stages of it. But I think, as I said, I know the 120 days still applies, because that's the minimum periods. But as I said, we also, as you know, again, the audit is qualified again this year, because they're putting in new systems to be able to overcome this problem. And just like we had at CIPC, as you know, CIPC got a qualified audit, and there was massive problems at CIPC. But we are giving it the management attention. As you know, we've also just put SABS under administration, and we've also had intense engagement with lotteries as well. We will be, as I said, that I can give you the undertaking that by the end of this administration, we will definitely work hard to ensure that these entities are offered for purpose, and so on. Honorable Williams, I think you raised the most interesting question, which is, as you correctly say, because the demand and the imports of manufactured products is coming from our big retailers, because we have just such a concentrated retail structure where there's three or four retailers, which makes up 90% of sales. As you know, we correctly told you that there is no legal instrument we can use to compel retailers to do it. But as I said, both the balance is changing, because, as you know, the currency depreciation is bad for importers. So as you can see, Mr. Price almost went into big trouble, because they were relying on imports. And when the rand depreciates, they have to pay more for imports. So
That is, we're getting feedback now that this is the opportune time to get an accord with the retail sector. We want to use the job summit process to get a voluntary accord with the retailers. There is a big project which IDD has undertaken with retailers, because now, fortunately, for the first time, our own retailers are facing competition from international retailers. As you know, H&M, Cotton On is taking sales away from our own internal players. So all of a sudden now, the retailers are our friends now, because they need support from foreign competition. So they used to always preach to us that we must accept globalization and we must accept all that, but now that H&M, Zara and Cotton On is eating their lunch, they are saying, no, we must go domestic. So we are saying we are very willing for that. We've got a big, the minister will be addressing all the he had his first meeting with the CEOs of the retailers, and there will be a big event with all the retailers where we hope to drive an accord with retailers to increase local content. But as I said, they say it's in their own economic interest, because the rand is definitely not going to be strengthening soon. On the question, Honourable Shlangwini, we're getting the details here, but Tandi Wines is not Tandi Pele's wines here, but it is, from what we understand, it is black-owned and black-managed, but we will maybe just confirm that for you. But I think it is an important question, because we try to expose a lot of the black industrialists to foreign markets, and we do that. Your issue, I'll ask hand over again if there's anything Malebo wants to ask. But as you say, compliance, and this is the difficult one. As you know, how do we monitor full compliance? Because on the one end, you want to give the company incentive quite quickly, because remember, our incentive creates jobs directly, because we only give money for machinery and equipment. So that's why we ensure that, and this is Honourable McClobo's point as well, the reason we know our incentives work and they have an impact, because we don't give money for feasibility studies and for consultancy fees and these kind of things. We ensure that there's a machine in place, and there's only one thing you can do with a machine: you can produce, and you can employ. You need to employ people. So that's why we need to get the incentives out to companies, because we help them and we lower their cost of investment. But what we do is we try to, as I said, you must meet all the laws of the country. So for example, you must maintain employment as well. You must, so we ensure that you don't retrench people. We also ensure that you comply fully with LRA, procurement regulations, all those things. But as I said, and that is why we need these certificates. We need your BE certificate, all those, your VAT certificate, that you're paying taxes, that you're compliant with SARS. Those are the kinds of things. But as I said, there's always a tension between having all this paperwork and getting the money flowing. Honorable Kachalia, on this issue, yes, we've engaged with this thing with the U.S., and I think the U.S. fully understands our position, and if we look at their statement, that as we've indicated with regards to our industrial investments and with the Investment Act, as you know, we give 100% commitment that there will be no expropriation of any of these industrial investments. It doesn't even arise. We are attracting investment. So we fully protect property rights. And as you know, this issue about property rights and is that we're trying to extend private property rights to black farmers as well. I think that I understand the purpose of this land reform. That property rights was taken from black farmers. And all we need to do is to restore property rights. So this is about extending capitalism and the private market to black people as well. So I don't think land reform is an attack on property rights, an extension of property rights to black people. On the question of, as I said, what are our options with regards to, I think, Honourable Kachala's point about Donald Trump, and then Honourable Mantash again about the BRICS thing. I think this thing is gaining some traction, this narrative about whether we need to be in BRICS and whether even a GOA, all these free trade agreements help us.
You see, as I indicated, the problem is our domestic.
This is quite an important, well, not quite, it is a very significant.
And why BRICS and AGOA is so essential to our growth. The problem is, as I said, you can't grow because your domestic demand is so low. Because, as I said, most of our population is poor, they've been excluded from the economy, they've been condemned to just low-wage labor. So you don't have demand in our own economy to drive your industrial sector, so you must export. So therefore, BRICS is critical because it opens up now very close export markets. If you take citrus, it has been grown by 140%. We are now the world's biggest export of citrus. The biggest market which is buying our oranges is Russia. So you need that market. So if you get a gift like BRICS and you get access to the world's biggest markets, you must be the most foolish person not to take that opportunity. So as you know, we've got massive now investments from, the only new investments in new OEMs is from China and India. We've got Mahindra, Beijing Automotive Works, producing 50,000 vehicles in Kucha. That's investment out of BRICS. India, Mahindra is opening up, Tata is opening up here. You're getting Vedanta in the Northern Cape. Multi-billion investment in the Northern Cape in beneficiation to Indian investor. As I said, Russia, a massive market for citrus and agricultural products. So you must take, we must grow. We won't have that. If you take how South Korea, Taiwan, all of them grew, the U.S. gave them an open market, Japan. They had free access into the biggest market in the world, and that's how they industrialized. Not on the 40 million people in South Korea. It was the 300 million people in the U.S. So BRICS is absolutely essential. That's why AGOA is so essential for us. Because AGOA, not even the European Union, it was through AGOA that Africa started its first clothing and textile industry in Swaziland, Lesotho, Tanzania, Kenya. Because the U.S. opened their market. Unlike the European Union, which has rules of origin, they've never opened their market to us. So I think, as Minister Mutlova said, on balance, these things are only good for us because it expands our market opportunities, these trade agreements, and we need more of them and we need to widen them. That's why we're having the Continental Free Trade Area. Imagine we have a billion market. As I said, we have a 30% tariff with Angola still. We've got 30% tariffs with Nigeria. If we can get lower tariffs there on the continent, we will be able to grow. And similarly, on your question of the incentives, the lesson is that, as I indicated, all our sectors, where we've put them consistently, like in autos, in clothing and textiles, in BPOs, in film, we've created new industries in those sectors. The lesson is we must extend incentives to more sectors. And that is how we're going to industrialize. Because as you know, what all other countries do when their sector gets into problems, like in agriculture, it was a problem in Europe and the U.S. They've got the biggest support programs for agriculture in the United States and in Europe. When the auto industry declined, Ford and General Motors collapsed, the American government bailed out Ford and General Motors. So now they still got Ford as a growing industry. So you need, and that is why I think the lesson from Trump is that he has broken with this orthodox economics, which basically said we must open our market and we must allow free trade to just happen. We must withdraw support and subsidies. It was a swear word. So what he's done, and unfortunately we swallowed this orthodox economics in the 90s. We opened our markets and we lost our industries. So they gave us the wrong medicine. And as I said, the only good thing about Donald Trump is that he's bringing back good economics again, which saying, adopt a strategic approach. Protect your markets where it's essential for you, but also always remain competitive by being export-orientated. And because we're opening up other markets, that's why, Honorable Kachale, we don't have that problem because our companies are all part of global value chains. So our Mercedes-Benz plant is not going to be more competitive if we create more local opportunities for them because they already supply global markets. And so on. So I think that is the point. I think finally on Honourable McPherson's point about the SOEs. Yeah, as you indicated, that the problem is there is
There's some SOEs. As I said, the municipalities has done well on the question of buses. Also, they've all done well on clothing and textile, because as you know, there was consequences there and so on. So I think that going forward, one of the recommendations we would want to make to ensure compliance, what we've been proposing here is that it must be CEOs and accounting officers which must take the final consequences for failure to implement procurement policies. So it must be the CEO of Transnet that must be qualified, or must be disciplinary action must be taken. Similarly, it must be the Director General if my department doesn't follow a procurement regulation, which does apply to other laws. So I think what we're saying is that there must be consequences for non-performance. But as I said, we've seen, for example, because of the active role of SACTU, we've seen full compliance with a lot of the clothing and textile imports and so on. Chair, I think that concludes our...
Yes, and as members will recall, we have already indicated we will factor in the annual report on incentive development in our program later on, a very important one. We are running 5 minutes late, and I know the office of the AG, members need to leave, you are excused. In terms of the DTI, you know, we are still addressing the issue of sugar, etc. So what we're going to do in just this minute, as we rearrange our seating a little, we will invite, of course, we have other members here from the sugar industry, and I'm not sure how many we have. I've only seen two. So members, you will break for lunch after sugar. We've done the German leg of the study visit. So where we are now is at 10:05 to 12 here, it's 11:45. We're starting on the briefing by DTI on the sugar regulations. Sorry, 11:45. But I am looking at the program. The program says that we would have done the study visit to Germany at 11:45. You will recall we have done that already. So we took a decision, rather than sit here for an hour, to just swing the program around. All right. So I'd like us to continue with the sugar, which replaces the item, this study visit report, at this time. Now, we do have Mr. Maglala here from the sugar SAFTA, so please come a little bit closer. And DG, I think we don't have any time to lose. I understood there were other members here. The one secretary has left with the schedule, so I don't have the names here, unfortunately. So can we start, please, DG?
Honourable Chair, I'm going to, I'm going to hand over to our Chief Director, Tumisa, and I'm going to, and Tandi Pele is our Acting Deputy Director General for Sugar. But what I can report is that we did, we'll go very quickly just to give you an update on all the issues, but I can then report that we did spend last week in a workshop with the entire industry in KwaZulu-Natal, and we did, I think, make some progress on working on both a plan for transformation of the industry, for growing the industry, and some suggestions on resolving the representation issue. There's that, but I'll ask please that you just take us through the presentation.
Thank you, DG, and good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, as well as my colleagues. I'll just quickly take you through the review of the sugar regulations in terms of the progress that we've made as DTI together with the South African Sugar Association. As a way of, I think, outline, I'll just look at the objectives of the review of the sugar regulations, and then the current sugar industry structure. I'll also look at the proposed sugar industry structure, and then as well as the proposed amendments to the sugar regulations, mainly the transitional arrangements that we have agreed upon in terms of the amendments of the sugar regulations. As a way of introduction, the Department of Trade and Industry is reviewing the regulation of the sugar industry to address the recognition of alternative associations such as the South African Farmers Development Association. So we are not only looking at SAFTA and other alternative associations or farmers associations that wants to be to participate in this strategic industry. And the aim of the review is to also ensure broad-based representation in the industry, improve competitiveness, and to promote mainly transformation and inclusive growth, which I think DG has alluded to that fact. I want to run through the presentation, Chair, just to make sure that I cover the key issues that we have been requested by this committee to look at in terms of the review of the regulation. This is basically the regulatory framework of the sugar industry, the current regulatory framework, which is mainly the Sugar Act number 9 of 1978, its regulations, which is the Sugar Industry Agreement of 2000, as well as the SASA Constitution. So mainly we are amending the two regulations, which is the SIA as well as SASA Constitution. That is the work that we have embarked on from last year up until now. Just to provide you the context in terms of the ministerial prerogative to change the regulations emanating from the Sugar Act, the minister shall amend the said constitution, which is mainly the SASA constitution. The minister has got prerogative powers to amend the SASA constitution as well as the SIA, which is the sugar industry agreement, in consultation, of course, after consultation with the association. So those are the powers that I would say exclusive rights that the minister has got in terms of the amendments of the sugar regulation. Just to look at the current structure that has been in existence, Chair, over the last 90 years, the top structure of the sugar industry, it's the South African Sugar Association Council, which has got the millers, which have got 50% representation, the South African Sugar Millers Association, and we also have the South African Cane Growers Association, which have got 50% representation at the council level. And then let me just quickly go through this one, the graph that indicates exactly what I'm referring to. So we have the cane growers as well as the millers, which have got 50% representation at the council level. That is the old structure that has been there over the last 90 years. And you would see in terms of the cane growers, we also have at a lower level your milling companies. And then in terms of the millers, we have the milling companies. In terms of the cane growers, we have plus 20,000 cane growers who are members of the South African Cane Growers Association. That was the old structure in terms of the sugar industry. So now, what we have done is detail in terms of the amendments of the regulation. We've gone through an intensive consultation process, as DG has indicated to that. We've consulted all the parties, starting from the South African Farmers Development Association, the millers, the cane growers, and there's still an ongoing consultation with SASA. But I think what is important is that we have concluded the first, I would say, process in terms of the amendments in April 2018. There was a draft agreement which was signed by all parties, which was approved by the SASSA Council. And then later on, I think there were challenges that were picked up by the associations, especially the small growers associations, after of the issues that were not properly, you know, deliberated on. And one issue, I think in the first round of negotiation that was not properly discussed was the levy sharing mechanism. So then we were requested to actually hold on the sort of gazetting of the regulations, so as to give a chance to the industry to relook at this matter. So SASSA actually requested that to DTI, and we actually allow them to go back to the drawing board. And then, but what we did was to say, SASSA, they requested that there must be a mediator in the process to facilitate the negotiations around this levy, I mean, around the levy sharing mechanism, because we knew for a fact that it was a hot issue, and therefore there was a need for the mediator in the process. But I think, lastly, I would like to indicate that even through the mediation process, the negotiations, they collapsed, and the industry could not reach any amicable solution. And that's when the DTI had to be involved now in the process on the 7th of September to inform SASSA of the new transitional arrangement, which should be extended by, I think there were two dates that I think we proposed, mainly March, up to end of March 2019 or up to March 2020, subject, of course, to the long-term transformation. I think that is the sort of a directive or guidance that DTI had to provide because of the collapse of the negotiations. So there was a consultation with all the parties regarding the new transitional arrangements, which I'm going to talk about now. In terms of the proposed structure, the new structure now, in terms of, I would say, transitional arrangements, this is the new structure which has been agreed upon by all parties, which is the cane growers, the millers, as well as the SASSA itself. This is the structure that has been agreed upon. Growers Association will have 50% representation at the council level, as well as the millers 50% representation at the council level. But if you look at the Growers Association, now you're talking about two associations, which is mainly your cane growers association, as well as SAFDA, which have got 50-50 representation at a growers association level. So which balances the representation in terms of the Growers Association. So indeed, the parties have agreed on this proposed structure. The levy issue, it's a hot issue, as I've indicated earlier on, that parties could not agree on this matter in terms of how levies will be shared. We made a couple of proposals on the 7th of September, and we agreed on this proposal that SASSA has to make use of the industry obligations, which is mainly one basket of levy, which includes the contribution from the millers, the growers, which is the cane growers, as well as SAFDA, where we're looking at one basket of levy, which is called the industry obligation or the industrial levy. So this is the proposal that DTI has put forward to the parties. And I think for us as DTI, the main, I think, benefit around this is the fact that SASSA has to provide now allocations in terms of the operational cost of all the parties, that is the cane growers, as well as the SAFDA and the millers, because they have to submit their operational board to SASSA, and SASSA will actually have to look at the rationality and justification in terms of those budgets around their operational costs. So that's why we're talking about now the industry obligation or the industrial levy, one basket of levy. So indeed, this is the proposal that has been put forward, which is going to be part of the transitional arrangement, rather than growers, you know, and looking at only one type of levy, which is mainly the growers' levies. But now we're looking at the whole industry obligation, the industrial levies, which all parties have to contribute to. the transitional arrangement, just to give you a high level there, grower representation in SASA will be shared equally by SAFTA as well as South African Cane Growers Association. And then for the transitional period, cane growers and SAFMA cost of operation and administration will be included in the industry obligations and deducted by SASA from the gross proceeds. And then also in terms of the transitional arrangement, we are now going to also include the long-term plans in terms of the industry, because what we have seen is that we are not supposed to only look at the short-term, because short-term is not addressing what we want to address in terms of the transformation, in terms of the growth of the industry. So now the transitional arrangements are going to include the long-term, the long-term plan of the industry, which will be actually gazetted as well. And then I must also indicate that there was a SASA transitional committee which was held on the 10th September, which could not agree again on the issue of the levies, again on the issue of the as well as the issue of the date for the transitional arrangements, because I've indicated earlier on that the transitional arrangements, there's a date that we need to put. It's either end of March 2019 or end of March 2020, subject to the long-term plan in terms of the transitional arrangement. And now that decision is going to be referred to the SASA Delegates Committee, which will be held, I think, around about 14th September. But as DTI, we are not going to actually focus on that. We want to move ahead with the gazetting of the transitional arrangement, including the long-term plan of the industry. Once again, the issue for consideration now going forward for DTI is to finalize the amendments to make sure that they include the transitional arrangement, including the end date for the transitional arrangement and the levy sharing mechanism, as well as the, so we are prepared to fast track the whole process in terms of gazetting the transitional arrangement. So hopefully before the end of this month, which is 30th of September, we should be done with the gazetting process. We are trying to fast track with our legal services so as to make sure that the current transitional arrangement, they don't expire before we can sort of gazette. In conclusion, the meeting held on the 20th September and 7th September between DTI and SASA concluded that the gazetting of amended regulations, including recognition of SAFTA and the transitional arrangement and long-term strategic planning process for the industry transformation, is of paramount importance and therefore should proceed as a matter of urgency. And furthermore, the transitional arrangement will be extended to the 31st March or the 31st March 2020, subject to the long-term plan, which has to be part of this transformation plan based on the minister's discretion. So in short, we have agreed that we are going ahead with the gazetting, including the extension of the transitional arrangement. If there's anything that I've left, DG, please let me know. I've tried to cover as much as I can, but also to indicate that we've got the details of the amended regulations, the FIA, as well as the SASA constitution, which we have provided to the committee, if you would like to have further details in that regard. Thanks.
Chair, that is from our side. As I said, the basic proposal is, as you know, the transitional arrangement is to allow 50-50 sort of association of national unity. We say between cane growers and SAFTA that we go 50-50 representation, and that they split the levies and they make their budgets available. And that what we're saying is, because they haven't concluded, we extend this either to next next March, or we give it six. But what we've emphasized to all the associations is that whilst they are very concerned about their internal arrangements, their voting and so on, the real issue is we must grow the industry. That, as you know, we cannot just rely on sugar. All other industries have survived by going into biofuels and ethanol and also into cogeneration. So we have to fast track that, and we're going to ask the support of the committee on this one. And Honorable
Slobo, you were there for a short while, but only at the end when I think we could have got through the biofuels. But as you know, we've been stuck with getting biofuels going in the country. So we need that blending done so that the sugar industry don't only have to sell sugar, because no consumers are cutting down on sugar. So you have to now produce fuel and energy. So and then secondly, they must have a clear plan for black economic empowerment. I'm pleased to report that, I mean, as you know, the agricultural sector is a real problem with regards to transformation. But out of the agricultural sector, the sugar is the best performer. And that's why we do have a Black Farmers Association. There is a black farmer constituency, but it's only at about 10%, less even, it's still on the margins. They need to move to empowerment levels of 30 and 50% black participation in this industry, especially because it is such a protected industry in this country. So we must get the quid pro quo on growth and empowerment. And then the other problem is, as I said, let's allow more mediation, but let's proceed with this 50-50 sharing arrangement.
No, thank you very much, DG. And also Chief Director Agro Processing, Ms. McCarter-McLawley, thank you very much. Now, just so that everyone understands what it is we're doing today, including SASTA, we asked for a detailed presentation from the DG on exactly where we are, what is the progress. And we asked for that so that we could prepare ourselves as a committee to engage effectively with the sugar industry. I think it's 3rd October. But right now, we've been made aware that there are certain challenges in the regulations, etc. This is our opportunity to look at it and also to be mindful and guided by what we said a few months back when we said it is critical that we link the transformation of the industry to this. Now, we all know what we said there and the importance of it. There's another dimension, of course, that the DG has put on the table now. Perhaps it was on the table before, but it wasn't emphasized. And that is, yes, there is the challenge that sugar, you know, we've been asked to cut down on that by health, etc. It's not all that good. So it is going to reduce in consumption. And in the absence of consuming it as a food, is there something else we can do in the industry? And how can that also be factored into the transformational arrangements? I hope I understood you clearly, DG. So I'm now going to look at hands. And members, this is an important industry. And I know some people even come from KZN on my left here. But Honourable McLawbo, yes. Honourable Buyani, Honourable Slanguini, Honourable McPherson. And I think where you are is at Umhlanga Rocks there. You're pretty close to the sugar, huh? Right.
No, thanks, Comrade Chair. Let's thank the DG and the team. This is a good intervention, DG, through you, Chair. Very good. But we need to get the handling well so that we don't lose certain aspects. But at the very same time, remember, we need to fix this car while it is moving. Firstly, let's note that at least the opportunity to look at the tariffs, Comrade Chair, the Minister has done the gazetting, as the report they have said. It's very good that it has been done. In other words, government is creating an enabling environment just to cushion the effect that is there. Remember, Chair, you raised the issues of Brazil and other areas. And at least we can't be accused that we have not processed that instrument. But we want the industry to be genuinely checked, that they never came here because they wanted this matter of the tariff. The fundamental issue that this industry must be inclusive must not be taken lightly. On the question of the transitional arrangement, Chair, I'm happy that DTI, we are saying that it has to be extended. But we must also look in the dim view of the lack of progress and that the negotiation collapsed. Let's support that DTI proceed with the extension, even if it's next year, but subject to review. But DTI don't allow a situation of self-regulation. Come closer, facilitate this thing. Facilitate that they come to an agreement, lead, government we lead, as the government of the Republic of South Africa as a whole. It doesn't mean that if people are in the private sector, you can't be involved. Therefore, let's support the transitional arrangement. And I'm happy that now, then there's issues of legislation, DG, you need to work on. Remember, the regulations have worked on them, but the legislation very thin and overtaken by time. Remember, as an old legislation, some of us were very young, not even toddlers or what, when this thing was made. The spirit of our constitution, redressing the imbalances of the past, the issues of redress, empower yourself to have the instrument. Let's have this legislation as a matter of agency while we are strengthening within the means of the Minister using the directives. On the transformation issue, Chair, I'm happy that you're saying they're coming back in October. The department must be able to take an interest in as much as they're trying to work on their own. As a regulator and an overseer yourselves, you need to be able to say what are these transformation imperatives without prescribing the how part of it. But the transformation imperatives for the industry, you have to be content as the department that they are correct or not. And over this period we've engaged with them, they've never came with them. The last point, Comrade Chair, I'm happy that there is a view to say let's grow the industry. Let's look at the value chain. The value chain, Comrade DG, for it to grow, firstly, there is a question that there must be an access to land. Therefore, the role of rural development in terms of getting more hectareage and in a land that is more friendly for this kind of plantation, the issues around the irrigation scheme infrastructure like Chair you normally speak to, let's look at that part. Then there is a between the farming of the sugar cane, and then there's a process of actually taking the cane itself, the logistics and other issues, into the meat, which is the production part. Then there's a question of speaking about of the byproducts. There are secondary industries we can create out of coming there as a byproduct. We are correct, the biofuels important, must be supported. And probably also when you come back in growing the industry per se, what is an impact around these issues of tariffs, the impact around the issues of the sugar tax and so forth, because there are these other things that might be having good intention but killing the industry. But let's support your recommendation. Transitional arrangement looks okay. The governance issues, DG, don't leave them. Get close. Get close, people must go in there. They must be no, what do I call it, fronting. Where people are brought into a committee, they have no faith. This thing of universal suffrage, you can't be using things like socio-economic status about voting. We're impugning on the others. We're just here, we are camouflaging so that you can get these things. We can't allow fronting and our people being used. Let them be there. And yourselves, you must say, how much do you want to pay as government for transformation? The industry must contribute, but government must also put a premium. Transformation for you to be able to leave people who are disadvantaged so that they can participate. Already there are 6 steps or 4 steps backwards. What is these incentives, Chair? Will they come in? You also have to walk the talk. We must not talk the talk. Let's also, as government, put our money where our mouth is. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Ms. Lobo. Honorable Buyani.
Chair, thanks. It's very much difficult to speak after Mashlobo. Honorable Mashlobo. But Chair, mine I think was on the facilitation and the collapse of the negotiations. Chair, Comrade Mahlobe has indicated clearly that we must renegotiate the process, and we must not leave this process like to collapse as well. And we must also emphasize that the government must lead, because government in South Africa is a democratic state. It leads whether it's a private or the public. Government must take initiative and lead the process of negotiation. So then the clarity here is on the 64% and 36% in terms of the industry obligation. I will need clarity here because, okay, the 50% on the transitional period is clear. I'm not so sure in terms of the 64-40 clarity. Then also, I see here on the presentation, it says the transitional period is, is the 1st of April 2018 until 31st 2019. But on the constitution, it says contrary, so we must check as to which one is proper. Chair, the transformation issue, man, I don't know whether the DG can be able to assist, because transformation is broad. The DG can be able to come up with a strategy, a transformation strategy, so that when they mediate, they come up with a strategy that says, how can we be able to balance the two? Because we understand from the past perspective in terms of this industry that black were not part, and we need transformation. And the transformation is not about taking 50-50, this is black, this is white, and put here. And also you say, no, we must go and vote. This is vote, hectare, vis-a-vis membership. We must be able to say, in terms of the transformation, how many hectares do blacks have in the process? That's transformation. And land that is available for blacks to able to manufacture. Then also, we must say, in terms of mechanism, because the machinery, the industry is so vast. We don't have this other kind, the millers. Yes. You have land, but you cannot have mills. So how can you be able to process all those kind of things? So that is my proposal and the clarity seeking question. But we must not take for granted the voting part. Because if you say the voting is not considered, we must not consider, is the problem. Because voting, we must be able to check how are we voting in terms of members. Because these ones have membership and these ones have hectares. Can we be able to vote in terms of the hectares? Because really, the heritage, it can tell you that white farmers, they do have a lot of hectares, and the black is just the membership. So we must be able to have a balance on those ones. Thank you very much, Chair.
That's an important principle there, DG, that the Honourable Buyani was spelling out. Honourable Sanguini?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to welcome and commend the department for the work they have put in. We have come a long way, definitely, in this particular industry. And as the DG has said, there are many other industries as well, not only the sugar industry. Mine is just maybe a point of clarity, Chair. I don't know who can clarify that for me. Is it maybe perhaps SAFDA or the DG or SASA? In terms of the levy sharing mechanism, I think they need to give us a bit more information as to the levy sharing and take us into confidence. Why have negotiations collapsed or delayed in terms of levy sharing? Maybe there can be underlying issues as well that we don't know about and stuff like that. And then the next one, Chair, it's on the long-term solution. I'd just like to find out from the DG, where will this be catered for in your legislation or regulation, this long-term solution that we are having? And also, thirdly, Chair, though we are talking about the biofuels and the ethanol and so forth, but our black farmers need to share in the value chain of this. Because remember, we are still transforming the sector. And now, as it stands, it's still not fully transformed. And we don't know what is the delay as such, and to sort of, if we're going to shift it to something else, it may delay the whole process. Yeah, that is all that I have for now. Yeah, the levies ones that I want to really find out as to why the negotiations have stopped in the levy process.
Thank you very much, Honourable Sangwini. Am I correct, Honourable McPherson?
Thank you very much. I think that any process like this doesn't happen overnight, and so I think that we must commend everyone for where they are. Is it perfect? No, it's not. So I think that we must always look to what is the end goal. DG, I want to understand one thing. If at the end of the day, whether it be March 2019 or March 2020, if no agreement was to be reached, what is the position then? Because I think that it's always good to know what is our best case scenario and what is our worst case scenario, and try and work as far away as possible from that worst case scenario. But if that worst case scenario is always an option, well, you know, we tend to gravitate towards that if it's in someone's interest to do so. So I just want to understand what is the worst case scenario versus the best case scenario. With respect to levies, I mean, that's a complicated issue, but I just want to just expand on what you said, that what we want here actually is a growing industry. Because if there's a growing industry and everyone is making profits, people don't argue over levies because there's so much to go around, who cares? But the fact of the matter is that the industry is under such incredible pressure that every rand counts at the end of the day. And so while it's important to worry about things like levies and sharing arrangements, we need to be equally committed and focused to growing the industry and making it sustainable. Which brings me to the point of why I don't think something like tariffs and this discussion are not linked. And I think that they are linked. Because if we had got, or if not we, because I'm not a farmer, if the industry had got their request for their dollar-based reference price, I'm not sure that this discussion would be as intense as it is, because people would be able to make their money and they would be able to share and everyone would be okay. And so I think that we must keep that in the back of the mind. You can disagree with me, that's fine. But I do think that there needs to be some further work on the tariffs and whether there is opportunity to actually relook at that particular arrangement.
Remember, we are coming back to tariffs. No, continue with them. Thank you, Honourable McPherson. DG, we're over in your court now.
To ask Seth and Sefta to come in, I can
no, no not at the, not at this point.
Okay. Okay. Then
the point is that the committee wanted to prepare themselves.
So, Then very quickly, I think honourable members have raised the critical issues. If I can very quickly, I think, Honourable Mtlomo, I think your point is, the central point you're taking is that government must take an active role and lead and guide this process. And I think we take that on board fully. And as I said, we are starting to increase our involvement. Myself, Tandi and Tumisa spent the day there with all the associations, one full day to try to broker settlements and to work with the industry. So we will continue that. And they've asked that we will now play a direct role in the mediation process during going forward. So your point is taken, Honourable Mtlomo, on the issue of the growth of the industry, the problem is that, as I said, government gets sometimes criticized for intervening in the economy. The problem is the opposite. Government inertia is causing a crisis in this industry. Because, as you know, the problem with sugar is that you always get overproduction in the world. Because just like you now had, the reason for the current problem is India, which is the first or second largest sugar producer in the world. They had a bumper crop. So they've got millions of tons. I think it's 40 million tons. They've bought extra on the world market. So it wipes out all other sugar producers. So you've got oversupply. And as you know, when oversupply happens, prices fall below the cost of production, and you have to go out of business. So the problem is, what all other countries have done, they've created new sources of demand. So Brazil, in 1973, they started the biofuel industry. And every country has gone into biofuels and ethanol. South Africa, through government inertia. We have even Zimbabwe as a... Zimbabwe, Malawi, all of them have a minimum requirement in your fuel. You must have a certain number of biofuel. So you can go up to 10%. South Africa is zero. So unless the government implements that regulation, and DTI has been struggling with the Department of Energy for more than 10 years now to pass that regulation. So, and under McPherson, the solution, you say, is not increased tariffs, because you're actually hurting yourself more. Because, you see, they always close to the maximum rate, sugar. But remember, once you increase the price of sugar all the time, the people who buy the sugar, like Tiger Brands, Coca-Cola, they will find substitutes for sugar. So it's not just that you can increase the price of sugar willy-nilly, because you know what happened with oil? Because oil price went so high, people have found substitutes for oil. And that is why, so you're hurting yourself. So the solution is not to constantly increase the tariff and the price of sugar. We can do it for a short-term problem because of the Indian harvest. The solution is to find, like every other country has done, you've got to diversify. And as I explained at the question of demand earlier, sugar demand is dropping because consumers generally are moving away from sugar products. There's sugar taxes even being introduced. Sugar consumption and demand is going to fall. Everybody is working on that assumption. And you can't just continuously protect your sugar industry. You must create new sources of demand. And there are two new sources of demand, and black farmers will benefit the most. Because any kind of sugar goes into biogen. No matter what the quality is of the sugar, you can do biogeneration. So if you do generation of energy and you do biofuels, you create demand for the industry, and then black farmers can enter the value chain and sell product and so on. So I think it's really important that we get that right. And then finally on the question of the levies, I think Honorable Slanguini, Guyani, you're raising the right point there. Because as you know, what is happening is there's a lot of, as I said, they're saying that the reason the negotiations broke down, because it obviously, as you know, there's a luxury in this industry, which no other industry has. Why people are fighting for members is because you get an automatic levy increase through a state regulation. So in another employers association, in Grain SA must go to each member and ask them to pay a membership fee, and it's voluntary. Here, SASSA has guaranteed income.
cane growers have guaranteed income. So that's why you have this fight. It's a fight about rents, which is imposed on people. It's not like other industries. So that's why, because I was very shocked when I saw all this fighting taking place. It's like when we were going back to the 80s, to the trade union days, where we were fighting for members. And I asked, how come employers are fighting for members like this? Can it be that they just want members because they love members so much? No. If you are recognized under this agreement, you get an automatic 50 million rand every year. You get guaranteed for you. So we mustn't now, so now people are saying, because SAFDA has now joined, now they're saying it's no longer one farm or one vote. You must go for tonnage you produce. And I reminded the group last week, you know, throughout the world, and even in South Africa, in KWV, people have always fought for this principle of one farmer, one vote. Whether you're a small farmer or a big farmer, you must never be dominated by the big farmers. Every farmer, no matter your tonnage, you must have, and KWV and the Afrikaners, when they created the co-ops, they insisted on the principle of one farmer, one vote. So I asked the association, how now today, you've always operated on the principle of one farmer, one vote in cane growers. Now, all of a sudden, you want to introduce tonnage and so on. People forget about that. So, Honorable Sangeni asked also, what's the final solution, or Honorable McPherson, if people don't settle on this matter? I think we're going to take the cue from Honorable Mufloko. Here, what we're going to do is we're going to now give clear guidelines that part of the plan must not just be fighting about levies and whether you get 50 million rand every year or not for your business association. Not for transformation or for growth, but you get money for your business association. This is what the levies is about. We're saying as a DTI now in this government, we'll solve that problem for you. But what you must bring now is, and that's why we're making it, it's part of the terms of reference, is you must ensure we grow the industry and diversify, and we must jointly work with government to open up the co-chain space, but they must commit to actual proper transformation targets. And we've been in touch with EmpowerDex. Boyo Jack is doing the work there. He started the base study. We've said we're going to set hard targets of 50% must be produced by black farmers in this industry. And we must use this industry as a model because they do have good infrastructure, they've got experience, and currently they're the most advanced on transformation out of the whole agricultural sector. So we must also commend the work of SASSA and cane growers and the association. Despite my earlier criticism, they have done the best. But they must set an example for us that if we can, we must set 50% as the target for transformation. And we're saying that it must be, we won't accept any plan which just deals with levies. It must deal with transformation, growth, and levies. And then if they can't reach an agreement, then as I said, in any case, this is the one, and that's why I think we must, the good thing about the sector is that, as you know, we made the big mistake in agriculture. We deregulated agriculture in the 90s. And all the big cooperatives were privatized. So KWV used to be the world's major successful cooperative. But post-1994, we made the biggest mistake. We liberalized, and we wiped out, and all KWV is now private.
Right.
So we lost. So, but the one industry we preserved was sugar. So therefore, they've got the research facilities there. They're well-equipped. And so, I'm saying we're really committed to rebuild this industry, but as I said, along those new lines around the levies.
Right. DG, sorry to stop you there, but as you noticed, we had catering facilities director coming here to remind me workers also need a break. Now, having said that, I just want to ensure that we recognize those involved in the sugar industry. I did recognize Mr. Madlala, the chairperson of SAFDA. I didn't recognize you, Honorable... the deputy chairperson, Ms. Ntlubi, is that right? And do I see Mr. Naidu sitting somewhere? No? Tricks. Tricks. Tricks Trickham. Right. Excuse my eyesight, you're sitting on the wrong side of my eyes, not right. There are many others who are here. This engagement, though, was so that you could hear what it was that the DG trade and industry shared with us, our own engagement, in order to prepare. And you will see that hinges on three things. How do we ensure the democratization of the sugar industry, SASA itself? We've been put forward. Let's try and consider one farm, one vote or whatever. And the other side of it is take into account tariffs. There is that coming up as well. But in the final analysis, we have to not only transform the political and social dynamics, but we have to change where we're going with sugar. It cannot only be sugar that we eat and drink. We need to consider other methods. So I do want to thank you for coming from the sugar industry. We are way over our time, 40 minutes, and we have to go to, is it V8? And we will be back at 2:15. Thank you very much, DG, and your team. Thank you to all of the stakeholders in the sugar industry. Thank you very much. And members, can we adjourn until 2:15 and come back here?